Planning Council. My name is John Moingard. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
Jack Schreier, Morris County Freeholder. I had the pleasure of passing through Surgeonsville over the weekend. Never saw it before. There it was.
Bill Goddard, Mayor of Chester Township.
Tracy Carluccio, Public Representative, Hunterdon County.
Amy Letts from Precipity in Morris County. Tanisha Wade, Passaic County Freeholder.
Elizabeth Calabrese, Bergen County Freeholder.
Tim Gillingham, I'm a public member from Mercer County.
Scott Waitnack from Morristown.
And from the Witness Protection Program on the phone, we have?
Deputy Pastor Lily from Warren County.
We have a quorum. This meeting has been advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have in our packets the minutes from our last meeting on September 20th. Make a motion.
I move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
For a second?
For a second.
Any comments from council members on the commission on the minutes? Corrections? Any comments from members of the public on the minutes? Yes, sir.
My name is David Schultz, and I mentioned this will be the third time now, but New Jersey American Water itself alone pays $58 million a year in franchise excise taxes and gross receipts taxes. It goes to Trenton where it is squandered. Please take a part of the minutes.
It's in the minutes. Are you saying that it's not in the minutes accurately the way they are here, or you just want to be sure they're in the minutes?
I've said the same thing. This will be the third time now. It's just simply not in the minutes.
We'll make sure it's there either in this minutes or another or the next one. Any other comments on minutes? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstain.
Okay. I have no items to report. Do other council members have anything to report at this time? Okay. We turn to the executive director's report. Eileen Swan.
Good morning, everybody. Just to give you an idea of what the staff have been up to since our last meeting 2 weeks ago. Obviously, the work continues on the next generation Highlands Regional Master Plan. We've been working with consultants Seaman and Larson on the vision statement because, we indicated to you at the last meeting, we not only push forward, we also go back and consider the comments that we keep receiving on the documents, both from yourselves and from the public, so that we keep refining those documents, and that will continue until we get to the point where we have a draft that's ready for release, if so decided upon by yourselves. So we've been working on refining that vision statement and likewise the policies and issues that you discussed at a former meeting. We include the comments received from yourselves, but also the state agencies. That work has been going on as well. And if in the sense that the comments, if they are applicable and are appropriate for inclusion, if not, we will be bringing them back to you for further consideration. The staff has also worked on the goals, policies and objectives in preparation for today's meeting. And I think it's important to note, once again, as we have been doing at these meetings, that the policy issues that you'll be working on today, goals, policies and objectives, are from the November 30th draft. So it's not as if they're all new. In fact, what this is a sort of distillation, a refinement, an editing process so that they become simpler, they become more user-friendly, and also that any duplication is taken out. What we did initially was to draw from the November 30th document all those goals, policies and objectives and put them in one place. And then the firm of Seaman & Larson changed the order of those so that they hung together in form of goals, policies, objectives, all of the documents without narrative between them. And then what we did was we did a review of those goals, policies and objectives in terms of comments received, again from yourselves, but also from the public comments received, that public comment period, which closed May 11th. So all of those comments were considered in re-evaluating goals, policies, and objectives. there was analysis and further research done and ground truthing. What we do is we look at these goals, policies and objectives, we look at the mapping we have, and we see how they will actually translate, how implementable they are, and that work then readies us as well for the programs portion of our meetings, when we come back to you then with the programs, how these goals, policies and objectives, how they will be achieved through programs. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody's on the same page of where we are today. So significant public comment has already been taken into consideration on goals, policies and objectives. We anticipate after today's meeting, again, more information coming in, particularly from the public, so that we will be able to once again refine this document and keep working forward with the council. The LANDS model continues to be tested and refined, and the original indicators assessed for any duplication. The additional indicators that we discussed at the policy issue council meetings are also being added and tested. And then we review them as in terms of some overlays that will be refined and some new indicators added to the LANDS model. And that is on your agenda for November 1st to study and reflect on some of the implications of that into the mapping. And of course the land use capability map, which is required by the Act, we'll be bringing you up to date on that at that November 1st meeting. Septic density approaches have been researched. This has been ongoing work by the staff, also in consultation with our consultant on the septic matters, and that is D'Amico and Associates. So we have in the goals, policies and objectives that you will be looking at with us today, we do have the targets for nitrates. But again, there will be subsequent meetings after today. Some work will be, we anticipate, at the October 18th meeting, and more when we get to the LANDS, the meeting when we look at the mapping, we'll be doing a lot of capacity studies as we're looking at the mapping. So we'll bring back to you more information on septic at that meeting as well. So again, it's an ongoing process. You do have in your packet today, so it will be discussed, the request for a TDR grant from Clifton. So I'll leave that till we get to that on the agenda. We've had our first meeting with the financial consultant, Greg Delapia, and he came into the office to have a look at what we've been doing, how we've been handling our accounts, and to work with Ranji Perso, who does that work for us in-house. And we'll be having a meeting with the Budget and Finance Committee Chair to introduce him to Greg Delapia and to sort of give an indication to Bill, our new chair, of what the programme will entail and what the Budget and Finance Committee should be seeing in terms of recommendations from Greg Delapia. We're also going to set up our meetings now with the two audit committees in anticipation of meeting our auditing requirements. So just to let you know, continuing with that work. The next council meeting is October 4th. 18th. October 18th, yes.
October 4th is today.
Thank you for that clarification. Welcome everybody, October 4th, and yes, we'll see us again October 18th. However, unbeknownst to me, somebody declared that Monday was a holiday, and thus I would like to ask the council's indulgence that we will not be giving you the new information for the next meeting until Tuesday evening, because I can then rely on the staff to pull things together so that we'll be able to give you some information in advance, as we have been doing, so that you can get back to us with comments, but that will be Tuesday evening rather than Monday.
The holiday, by the way, is to commemorate Columbus's discovery of Ireland.
Jack, you don't want to hear my dissertation on St. Brendan's discovery of America. But I thank you for that as well. We have had committee meetings since our last council meeting. We had the Natural Resources Committee meeting, and the chair will advise you on that meeting. And this morning, October 4th, we had our agency coordination meeting under Chair Jack Schreier. We've had some municipal and county outreach meetings. I do continue to let you know that these are very important meetings. It's our way of starting that partnering process with various municipalities within the Highlands region. So when asked to do so, staff go out and we do a presentation and we answer questions from both the governing body and any other, if they've got planning boards in attendance, environmental commissions, zoning boards of adjustment, whoever is there, we answer the questions, and to the public. Since our last meeting, we held two of those. One was in Hackettstown at the invitation of their council, and one in Califon as well. We also met with town officials from West Milford with their MUA, NJDEP, and discussed waste management planning coordination with them. And while I'm on the matter of wastewater management, I did want to acknowledge that Glenn Schweiz was with us today, and we thank him for being here. He's the executive director of Morris County MUA. So I think this kind of coordination is critical for us. And so if he wants us to have a meeting at any point in time, obviously we're here and that's what we do. We've had the Califon meeting as well. That was another meeting where Califon had questions as to they're fully within the preservation area, but they wanted to have a conversation about where we are with the draft plan, what it means to them, and the particular difficulties that face them. Just like any municipality we talk to, we're all very unique. They all have different concerns, and they like to have staff there to start that relationship. And it's an opportunity for us as well to talk about grants that we have that are available so that we can, just as we are today with Clifton, we can start assisting municipalities in preparation for various components of the plan that they might be able to use to their own advantage. We've also had some constituent outreach meetings. We have constantly into the office, we have calls from constituents, we try to assist them. Sometimes the matter is in the purview of DEP, but nonetheless we talk with the constituents, we advise them as to what the Act says, what our role is, and if we can assist them in, if their question needs to be directed to a different department, we do that. We work with them. We tell them the, sort of the best calls for them to make to get the answers that we need. Ongoing state and federal agency coordination. Tom attended the Smart Growth Policy meeting in Trenton, and that's a meeting where it's under the auspices of the Office of Smart Growth, but they bring together various state agencies to discuss issues that are important for that kind of coordination. And so it's important for our office also to be representative there. So normally speaking, either Tom or myself go to that. Tom also attended the council staff meeting, the Plan Implementation Committee meeting of the Office of Smart Growth and State Planning Commission. And they will be having another meeting, like we did this morning, to discuss the ongoing status of the MOU between Office of Smart Growth State Planning Commission and the Highlands Council. And I believe that's slated to be October 24th.
That's correct.
And either myself or Tom will be at that meeting. I did also want to bring to your attention a bill that was to be discussed in committee. It was actually to be discussed today. And I'm quite glad that they put the discussion off, because it's a meeting that certainly that this council would like staff to attend. It's a discussion on a forest stewardship bill introduced by Senator Paul Smith. It's S2677. And it takes two very important steps forward in improving the stewardship of private forest lands. The owners of these lands currently have property tax savings under the state's Woodland Assessment Program, which is part of the Farmland Assessment Program. But in many cases, the land is being managed in a way that sometimes the farmer in question is doing it just to meet the requirements of farmland assessment, and that means the cutting and the harvesting of wood. And the consideration from this bill is that the forest stewardship, that the standard woodland management plan that is currently required to receive that property tax reduction would allow woodland owners to engage in habitat restoration, endangered species enhancement, invasive species control, deer control, and forest regeneration projects without that burden of meeting the yearly income required from cutting trees. And when we sent out the goals, policies, and objectives, Tracy had reminded us that the council had taken a policy issue stand on this before, and reminded us that this should be in the goals, policies, and objectives. So we have to do that, add that policy in, but also to bring to your attention that that bill is being considered in committee, and that we would have staff there to recommend the passage of that bill. Also, the S2677 requires that all woodland management plans on private land must eventually be upgraded to forest stewardship plans. And those forest stewardship plans are the plans that our Act refers to and gives exemptions to the forest stewardship plans. So this is another important move forward. Currently, there's no date for consideration by the committee. What they're saying is that conversation should occur after the election. So that brings you up to date, and I think it folds nicely into the goals, policies, and objectives for you today.
Thank you. Notice that Janice Comets has joined us since we did the roll call. Eileen mentioned the next meeting of the council, October 18th. We had discussed possibly changing the time of that meeting, and that turned out to be more disruptive than helpful, so the time remains at 10 o'clock 2 weeks from today. The holiday is this coming Monday, so the packets we receive, or the information we receive in advance of the meeting, I guess, will be October 9th, so we'll have it for 9 days or so before the meeting. I also want to recognize here with us today is Jim Gilbert, who was the first chairman of the State Planning Commission. So welcome. Glad to see there's life after being chairman of the commission. Jim is right there. You want to wave? Thank you. Thank you very much. We turn now to the committee packets, the committee reports. In our packets is the current listing of committee membership of the council. It has one error that I know of listing Jeff Gates as a member of the committee, and he helps out with that committee on loan from the Water Supply Council. But for members of the council, as you look at that, one day if you say anything incorrect, let the staff know, let Eileen know. But if you see committees you would like to be on that you're not on, there's no way to get off a committee. But if you want to get added to the committee, let me know. We turn next to the Natural Resources Committee. Tim Dillingham.
Mr. Chairman, the Natural Resources Committee met on September 20th. On the agenda were reviews of two water quality management plan or wastewater management plan amendment proposals, one for a project in Randolph, one for a project in Mine Hill, and also a discussion of draft procedures for the nomination, evaluation, and inventory of scenic resources. The committee had a fairly lengthy discussion reviewing each of the proposals, and those are described in the chair's report in the package. But I will say that the staff review, which evaluated the consistency of the proposals with the policies and standards of the draft regional master plan, brought to our attention fairly extensive conflicts with our policies on the protection of open water areas, riparian areas, extensions of public water supply systems into the protection area, as well as water supply issues with the projects being located in watersheds identified with deficits of net water availability. The recommendation from the staff on both the projects was to recommend denial after taking testimony or input from both the public and representatives of the applicants. The committee voted to forward those recommendations to the council for their consideration. I will note that they're not on the specifically, we're not asking for the council to take action today. We should have clear, I guess, that we would like to try to move these from subcommittee to the full council for their full consideration, sort of at the next council meeting. We should probably be more specific about putting those into the agenda that way. I will ask, there was a request from the applicants at the Kushner project in Mine Hill about a desire to present additional information, and I guess I would ask the executive director whether or not any additional information was submitted by them to the staff here.
The request was that we consider additional information, and we said that we would accept additional information. However, we did add the caveat that extra information should either have previously been shared with DEP or shared upon sending it to this office, because it's important to remember that what we're required to make a recommendation on is the application before DEP. So we must make sure that it's consistent, because we can't be offering recommendations on something that DEP weren't considering. So with that in mind, we received letters from both applicants, Heritage 55 and Canfield Mine Hill, and both of Minefield did indicate that they filed an OPA request because they wanted to see what information we had that we had received from DEP, so that they could see if they felt that there had been information shared with DEP previously that we didn't have on hand. We have complied with the OPA request, and we received a letter, I believe it was the day before yesterday, which indicated that they are putting a package of information together for us. So when we get that information in, we're going to have to review it, and we're going to have to check with the Department of Environmental Protection that they do have the same information, and possibly have a meeting with them to make sure that we're, again, reviewing the application that is before them, because our requirement is that's what we're meant to be making a recommendation on. And I'm saying that simply because, seeing as we've now moved our meetings to every 2 weeks, I am concerned about the timings, because we've yet to receive it, then review it, then have that meeting, and then advise the council when it's before the council for action. I know that we've been very much pushing the staff and the council, moving these WQMPs forward, because they're now out for public review. That's the point when we bring them to you. In the case of these applications, the applicants at that meeting indicated that they were the ones slowing the process down at this point, because they were asking us to take in this extra information. But obviously we'll comply with whatever it is you ask us to do in whatever time frame you direct.
Well, I think we should, Tim and Eileen, I should talk after the meeting and see how far we get into, whether we get through everything today and whether, in fact, there's going to be time to do that in the next few weeks
Mr. Chairman, I think that what Eileen was just describing is important for the committee to have before it, prior to the committee meeting, so that that knowledge that the DEP and we have the same information should be well known to us at that point, at the time the applicant comes before us.
We had a fair amount of discussion, Jack, about the fact that the applicant ought to be the primary point of contact on these issues for the time being ought to be the DEP. And so we clearly wanted to not get into a situation where the applicant was either not providing information to one agency or the other, or that they were dissimilar information. So that since we are in a position right now of offering comments to the DEP as opposed to undertaking a primary review, we tried to emphasize that the real point of contact was DEP, and that we were reacting into what was being given to us. So that the fundamental interaction was with the DEP, not necessarily directly with the applicant. I will also add, though, that in the staff analysis and in the discussion, that the degree of conflict of these proposals with the RMP is so great that there really was not much we heard at the committee meeting to indicate that there was a lot of room to resolve those conflicts. But clearly, I think that's one of the analysis we'll have to do as we see what information was presented and take that into account in the scheduling of moving forward to the council.
Finally, Mr. Chairman, the executive director referred to the Canfield application in Mine Hill as Minefield. Yes, it is.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, we also, the staff has developed draft procedures for the nomination, evaluation, and inventory of state resources, which, as we all know, is one of the charges under the Act. They did a great job. I think they were very responsive to public comment that we've gotten over the last couple of months. Several times we've considered this. There is a process that not only identifies the five types of resources, but a nominating process which will allow for municipalities and the public to nominate scenic resources and then lay out sort of how we would evaluate that and incorporate it into the regulatory reviews. And the committee's sense was that document was sufficiently developed that we should move it forward for public comment. So we directed the staff to put it up on the website. We'll take public comment, we'll factor that in, and then we'll move that forward at the appropriate time.
Yes. Tim, just wanted to add one thing to that two-week time frame that Eileen's talking about. We had a lot of discussion about how these reviews would move forward, and one of the important pieces is to make sure that the Natural Resources Committee does its work before stuff comes before the council. So we thought we had done that before the committee meeting. They asked for, the applicant said, we want to put more information in. I just want to say, before that comes to the council, I think there should be at least some sort of evaluation by the staff that goes to the Natural Resources Committee, not necessarily a meeting, but just so we know, so we don't come in here and then the whole council has to do all of that review without the Natural Resource Committee kind of, analyzing it ahead of time.
Right. And again, I think what I was trying to make was I think that the question, the key question is whether or not that new information resolves the conflicts the staff identified initially, and that would change the recommendation.
Agreed.
Right. Right. Thank you. From the other committee, which met earlier today, the State and Federal Agency Coordination Committee, Jack Trial.
Yes, we were privileged, I guess is a good way to put it, to have Ben Spinelli, the Director of the Office of Smart Growth, here with us this morning. And we reviewed the process by which the Office of Smart Growth and the Highlands Council will be dealing with something.
Memorandum.
The coordination of the planning process, the coordination on the state plan and on the RMP between the OSG and the council, coordination for plan conformance and plan endorsement, TDR, and finally and probably most significantly, coordination between the OSG and the council on redevelopment approvals, grants, and other approvals, and a lot of discussion centered on the final object, which was the issue of currently designated town centers and what their future is. And in a nutshell, town centers have an expiration date. That designation will expire at some point, and the town centers will be reconsidered by the Office of Smart Growth and the state and the Highlands Council. Is that a fair evaluation, Tom? Do you want to add anything to that?
No, that's correct.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next item, we have a consideration of a resolution concerning a feasibility grant on the transfer of development rights from Clifton. Eileen, do you want to present this to us? In our case, the material's all in our packet, a memorandum from Eileen, and supporting material added to that resolution.
Okay, we received an application from the City of Clifton in Passaic County. They want to look at the feasibility of becoming a TDR receiving zone for Highlands TDR credits. They, the grant that we had put out was for $25,000. Clifton is seeking $40,000 under this grant to conduct the work set forth. It's $15,000 in excess of the grant cap, but that's because the city will be conducting a citywide analysis for identification of possible receiving zones. This differs from the grant provided. The only other grant we provided for this was to Lopatcong, but in the case of Lopatcong, they're examining only one or two potential sites. Clifton wants to do a citywide evaluation, and they did give us a spreadsheet, which I shared with you, that would that shows where the work will be done and what they're hoping to achieve, and the necessity for the $40,000 grant. I wanted just to remind you as well that we had set $1 million aside from our grant monies in order to, just for this fiscal year, in order to offer this opportunity to municipalities. Also, Clifton, when we, there was the hearing in committee on the possibility of the new state TDR bill that would allow receiving areas for the Highlands and the Pinelands to be throughout the state. At that point, Dennis Kerwin, who submitted this grant application, actually testified and told the committee that he would, that his town city was considering utilizing Highlands TDR credits. So the staff has done an analysis of the grant application and the request for monies and recommends to the council that we move ahead and grant, give this grant to the City of Clifton in order to do this analysis.
Would someone like to move the resolution?
Can I just ask a question?
Somebody get the resolution.
So moved.
Okay.
Second.
I'd just like to ask a question. Do we have any idea how much undeveloped land that there is in Clifton? I know they've been anxious to participate with us for a while.
We can pull in Jeff LaJob and do the primary review if you'd like.
Just curious. I mean, I worked there once upon a time. It's not It's not overflowing with them two properties that I recall, so.
No, but they may indeed use an underutilized area, what's termed great field, they may use an area of that for redevelopment opportunities. But do you want us to get Jeff for a further?
No, I was just curious if anybody had any.
To agree with you, I know Clifton is not on the lot of land, but I think that the possibility for redevelopment is right in that city. So isn't that what we're looking for?
That's the primary base, yeah.
Isn't that what we're looking for? Yeah.
Yes. Other comments or questions? Comments from members of the public on the resolution?
I just wonder if any part of this grant money will be used by Clifton to down zone to meet 5 acres or 5 units per acre.
But that's not part of the
program. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments? Okay. All those in favor of the resolution?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
One.
Okay. Resolution passes, and I'd like to commend the staff on getting this to us and enabling us to consider it and pass it less than 2 weeks after the application was submitted.
And John, just as a reminder, the TDR committee is meeting next Thursday.
Okay. At what time?
3 o'clock, I believe.
I thank you for that, Mr. Chair, and would like just to say that Jeff LaJava was responsible for that turnaround, and so it was grateful.
Is there 4 p.m.? 4 p.m., okay. The 11th. Did someone just join us on the phone? Or someone leave us?
Debbie left.
Okay. Okay. We turn now to item 10, which may take a little longer than some of these other items. Discussion of goals, policy, and objectives for the regional master plan.
Yes, Mr. Chair. What we decided to do to facilitate this meeting was we put together a basic, and I really mean very basic, PowerPoint, which just really highlights the introductions to each chapter for the or each issue for the goals, policies, and objectives, and then highlights the goals. So that what we intended to do using this was really to focus on where changes had occurred, because as I stated earlier, this document is a refinement of what was in the November 30th draft. So the cyclical approach that's been described to you before, between ourselves and the consultants, this information has gone backwards and forwards, has considered council comments, state agency comments. But in order to facilitate it, because it is a lengthy document, we felt that we could just use the PowerPoint to focus us on the issues.
And just to be clear, the document in our packets is slightly different than the document council members received that we could have.
I'm sorry.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yes, this has gone through a lot of changes from the document you first saw, and so I think this would help you. And what Charlie and I will do is we'll just sort of backwards and forwards through this. We'll talk through it. We'll answer questions as directed by the chair. And if we feel that it's necessary, we do have staff with us here that if we do need to get more technical responses, we will. I will ask the staff then to respond.
Okay. I just want to amplify what Eileen said during her report. These goals, policies, and objectives, I would guess 70% of the substance was in the November draft. They have been reorganized and substantially rewritten in many cases, but substantively, I think there's been no change. The balance of it, I don't believe there's been any material change. There has been additional material provided. It is a work in progress. The concept here is we have chapter one of the plan, next generation will be the introduction. Two is the data and analysis. Three is the vision and the needs assessment. four are the goals, policies, and objectives driven by the data analysis, the vision, and by the act, informed by the public comments, and then the programs will be designed, are being designed to implement those goals, policies, and objectives and the requirements of the act. And so we're building a consistent link from the science to the policy to ultimately to the programs, and finally the last chapter to implementation responsibilities. So that's what's here. We've organized it. This represents a new table of contents, I think, that you'll see in the final document as we are organizing the goals, policies, and objectives. The programs and the implementation will follow the same organizational format that you see here, so that the first set of programs in what will be Chapter 5 will address natural resource management.
Just as well to take something, one thing off the table, the numbering did cause some people difficulties trying to follow the numbers through goals, policies, and objectives. I would ask you not to focus on that. We will be coming up with a new system for numbering it that hopefully will be easier to follow, so that if people want to cross-reference, it won't be 1521369. So if I could ask you not to concern yourselves with that at this point, and trust us that we will come up with it. It'll follow the same format, but the numbering will be simplified.
But just so you understand, the reason we did this was a way that we could keep track of policies and goals, policies, and objectives, and eliminate duplicates. Every other numbering system we tried, we lost things, and we couldn't. So I apologize for the 1111, but when you're doing what we're doing is comparing and eliminating or adding and substituting, it was useful from that perspective. The first part is natural resources, and the first subpart are Highlands Forest Resources. There's a brief introduction that is just intended to provide an overview of the central ecosystem function. Recall that when I talked to you about the format of the next generation of the regional master plan, we want to anticipate all kinds of different readers. And so someone who happens to be looking at the goals, policies, and objectives, we want them to be able to get a brief overview of what the subject matter is. Obviously, this is not intended to replace the material that's in chapter two. And the essence is the provide essential ecosystem function, provide for surface water filtration, habitat, and where possible, manage for sustainable use of forest. It also, we call out to remind that there are activities which are exempted from our purview, and so they are identified. The first goal, which I believe comes directly from the Act, is the protection of large areas of contiguous forested lands of the Highlands region to the maximum extent practical. I think everybody understands that these large contiguous tracts of forest are an important resource, both in terms of the landscape itself, but the habitat it represents, and the role it plays in preserving water quantity and quality. And I will just keep going, I guess, until somebody wants to talk about anything on either of these subjects. Then there is also a protection and enhancement of forests in the Highlands region. There are these large contiguous tracts in the preservation area particularly that are very important. But forest and woodlands play an important part throughout the region. And so there is also a protection and enhancement policy for throughout the region. Finally, the essential ingredient here is that conforming municipalities and counties include forest protection programs in their master plans and development regulations. Our job is to identify and direct. We hope their job will be to adopt programs and implement. You're the master of the
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Question. We have had a lot of discussion about forest clear cutting, and under the first goal, number here is 1115, it says to prohibit clear cutting except in a forest resource area, except in accordance with the forest. Now, I thought we had discussed this and in the plan put stronger language in to say that to discourage clear cutting in the forest resource area. And I just wonder, I had suggested an edit there that said 1115 to prohibit forest clearing within the forest resource area except to the extent necessary to promote native forest regeneration in accordance with the forest management plan. And I guess, you know, throughout this section, as I read this, I was thinking about our discussions about forest management plans and is the state of the art of these plans protective enough for the forest resources of the highlands? And if we're, you know, relying totally on forest management plans to be our guide, and they require, or I mean allow clear cutting, then I don't think it is protective enough. And so the alternative would either be to put that edit in or to consider us developing our own version of what a protective or highlands version of a forest management plan is.
Now, I just wanted to clarify that this portion of the goals, policies, and objectives is in very much in response to the comments we received, particularly from the New Jersey Forestry Association, and we wanted to be very clear as to what is under our purview and what is in fact exempt. And so the policy that Tracy is referring to is currently written as to prohibit forest clear cutting within the forest resource area, except in accordance with a forest management plan approved by the state forester, and that clearly follows the exemption. So our concern is that we cannot go beyond what the law allows us to do.
Well, in that instance, which I figured that's what you were thinking here, because the forest management plans are exempt, but can we then put our staff to work at developing a highlands forest management plan that perhaps then could be accepted by the forest community through a process. I mean,
you're talking about this as a post-plan adoption activity?
If the law does not allow us to do this here now, we had talked about near-term goals over the next couple of years that we'd be working on. I would throw that into a near-term goal.
But I think that.
So
I think we can put that in.
Yes.
I mean mid-term goal. Post plan adoption.
But early.
Then I think there's no reason why we can't put something together working with, we've been working with our own staff and with Ron Farr as well on this, and with the New Jersey Forestry Association, so we can put a sort of a place marker in place to say that we'll do that research, come up with something, and then work in coordination with them to see if we can sort of reach an understanding. So we'll certainly do that.
Thank you.
Why don't you go finish going through forestry, and then we'll get to the comments.
We're done.
I was sort of the flip side of Tracy's question, maybe. We had a lot of comments on the draft plan from the state forester community, I guess, about feeling that the draft was reinventing a process that we were not going to be equipped to implement, is the way to put it. How does this address those comments?
We worked with those comments on this redraft to make sure, and that's where we tried to make sure that we captured that and that we didn't go into what we shouldn't go into. So in response to the public comments, that's why we inserted the text at the beginning of the section that clearly acknowledged the forestry exemption. That was section 37.30.7 of the Act. We inserted that text that clarifies that the Act seeks to protect large contiguous forests. And therefore, the RMP, then we went on to create goals, policies, and objectives for all other non-exempt forest-related activities. So we also clipped the forest resource area, GIS layer. We clipped that to only forested lands so that we wouldn't include associated non-forested lands, which was one of the criticisms from the November 30th draft, because resource layer is a density layer, and therefore it speaks to where the resource should be valued if indeed those forested lands are present. So we made sure that we responded to those comments, and that's what this reflects now. Also simplified the goals, policies, and objectives so that we wouldn't replicate management plans already required for those exempt activities.
And Mr. Chairman, I might just add, when the programs are added, are expressed in what's Chapter 5, I think it'll be very clear about the relative responsibilities that was left, I think, unclear in the prior document, and that caused some of the anxiety.
Mr. Chairman, sure. Just have a question. Is this supposed to include tree farms, the goals and standards that we're establishing for forestry? One of the reasons I asked, when you talk about reforestation and all, when we took our tour of Highlands Farms, we went to a tree farm. And one of the things that the owners stressed was, it, from their standpoint, was the difficulty of maintaining the trees in the forest because of a very sensitive issue, but because of the wildlife and what it was doing, particularly the deer. I don't know if we want to include that in as just a suggestion.
I want you to just take that as a comment for now. And
right.
Yeah, I have a question on the conforming municipality section. And here we say a model municipal tree ordinance under objective, I guess, 11323. And that relates to active forests. But then at the bottom we get to the objective 113. Last one, it says standardize a tree protection ordinance throughout the Highlands region. We're talking as it relates to forests or as it relates to trees? At the municipal level, we have lots of consternation going on right now about tree ordinances. So are we talking about a tree ordinance in the municipality as conforming, or are we talking about a tree ordinance as it relates to forests with the municipality?
Well, I'm not sure
many of the municipalities within the Highlands, just as you were saying, Mayor, do have tree cutting ordinances, tree clearing ordinances. The problem for us is the lack of consistency in those, and then why they're in place and what they attempt to protect. What we try to do here is to make these consistent with approved forest management plans. So the object here is that we would create in that appendix some model ordinances that would speak to, and possibly more than one type of ordinance, but that would speak to that consistency with the New Jersey Forest Service Community Forest Program as one.
I'm with you on the forest part of it. I'm not with you on the tree ordinance, because we're having a difficult time finding one that's legal that we could, that's enforceable. So I'm just curious that if we're not going to be in that game of trying to determine legal tree ordinances for municipalities, or are we? Is that what your intent is?
Well, if you'd allow us to pick this up again under the programs, and we'll see if we can then answer the question at that point.
I bring that up.
I think that the focus of these two provisions you've referred to is that tree ordinances should be consistent with the approved forestry management plan, and I think that's what they're intended to address.
Okay.
Though I will tell you that in the community character section of the programs, tree cover is a is emerging, at least in our minds, is a very important consideration. So that's a work in progress.
But at a minimum, the wording needs to be clarified here, so we know whether we agree with this or not.
I'd like to get off this point as well, but I do want to say that in my municipality, we have worked with other towns on creating and drafting legal tree ordinances, tree protection ordinances, and those models are available to the mayor of Chester Township if he'd like to look at them. But I also think beyond that, it's very important that we be careful to not overly intrude into municipal government ability to craft a tree ordinance that suits their particular community character or their interests. So I think it's a high wire that you have.
And that's one of the reasons why the ordinances were to be placed into an appendix format, because we felt that in many cases it will be the municipalities, when they come forward with their own notions and ideas, that will be added to our work if they reach the standard or, and in many cases, maybe superior to. So.
We appreciate the work.
We also just remind you, we will be adding the policy that we spoke of earlier, that Tracy had reminded us of, and that is that the woodland assessment, that in terms of the bill that I told you that was before committee, so we'll be adding that policy. The next subpart is Highlands Open Waters and Riparian Areas. We start each of these with sort of an introduction. In this case, the Highlands Regional Master Plan focuses on four areas of action, and this is to address the need to protect, restore, and enhance Highlands open waters and riparian areas. The first is to identify and inventory each type of resource area. And certainly we've been doing a lot of work on that and have done in the past, evaluating the integrity of each type of resource area, and establishing resource protection measures, and establishing programs to promote consistent standards for the protection, restoration, and acquisition of important waters and riparian areas in throughout the region. So we have a series of goals here. We did, from the first draft to what we have before you here as well, is we took out some of what were coming as objectives and are now will form part of a glossary to explain what Highlands waters are, special waters, exceptional waters, and intermediate waters. They all fall under the first goal, which is protection, restoration, and enhancement of Highlands open waters and riparian areas.
And on that subject, at some point in the proceedings, not necessarily today, we've been wrestling about where to put definitions in this document. And if anyone has any, I mean, there are many schools of thought. You can do one in each chapter with the terms that are appropriate. You do a glossary at the end or definitions at the beginning. We have not tackled that task yet. But we're interested in doing it on the most user-friendly basis, and I would appreciate any input that anyone has with regard to that. We don't have to do it now, but it's, and that's part of the reason why these definitions have showed up here, is because we're bringing it to you, and we know there's some defined terms. You'll see another couple of defined terms. There's one about growth-inducing traffic road improvements. There's no definition that we've provided. So that's just a general comment that ultimately we're going to have to pull these definitions out, and we need some guidance from you all as to the ultimate users, your perception of ultimate users, how best to do that. The next is, I think that's, unless I have made a serious, everything else falls under as policies and objectives. This is, I think, very, very consistent, although I think improved in its presentation from what was in the November plan.
Okay. The next subpart is on steep slopes. And we first in our introduction speak to the roles of steep slopes, those roles being ecological, recreational, scenic, and functional. Disturbance of the areas can be problematic, and we list some of those reasons. It can be problematic because of erosion and sedimentation, disturbance of habitats, degradation of surface water quality, the silting of wetlands, alteration of drainage patterns. The identification...
This looks like a solo act coming.
Obviously, the identification and classification of these steep slopes is important in order to effectively manage critical natural resources in the region. And then we follow with the goals.
Protection and enhancement of the natural, scenic, and other resources of the Highlands region by protection of steep slopes from inappropriate development. And there are a series of policies. I think most of these are very similar to what was previously in the document. And other than in other parts of the document, we've called out, added to it policies reflecting the importance of steep slopes because of their typical wooded character play in the character of particularly of the existing built community.
Mr. Chairman, question on that section. The policy 1314, which addresses, it says all lands other than riparian areas with a slope 15% or greater but less than 20 and are non-forested. I believe, looking through the November draft, that those were considered moderately constrained, which makes a difference because then the moderately constrained has certain requirements. My concern is that lands that, and on 1313 as well, forested lands that are between 15 and 20 and lands that have difficult erosion and bedrock and soils problems be classified as moderate. Is that a change? When you look, I mean, this section, when you were trying to,
Councilperson,
got all mixed up.
If there's a change, it's an error. There was no change, no substantive error change, and to my knowledge, it did follow it, but I've made a note and I'll check.
Okay.
But there's no intended change.
Right.
And I was the author of this, so.
We do intend, as we go through this, to really highlight where there are changes, and so we'll definitely verify that with the RMP from November 30th. But definitely, as we move to the next subpart, which is critical habitat, you will see that there are changes, and this is one that we did really want to draw your attention to. So the next subpart, critical habitat, and this is where we speak to the variety of plant species, animal species, and all other organisms found in a particular environment, and they are critical indicators of ecological viability. The Highlands Regional Master Plan, in accordance with the Act, we seek to protect rare, threatened, or endangered plant and animal species of the region. There are three categories of critical habitat. Critical wildlife habitat, which is habitat for rare, threatened, or endangered species. Significant natural areas, those are regionally significant ecological communities. And vernal pools, confined, ephemeral, wet depressions that support distinctive and often endangered species that are specially adapted to periodic extremes in water pool levels. And it is that section, it was brought to your attention before when we discussed policies and issues. So we want to focus on the goals and objectives in particular as they refer to vernal pools. If you recall, in the November 30th edition of the Regional Master Plan, there was a 1,000-foot buffer in the mapping of vernal pools.
You'll never forget that.
Thank you. And that map, the that buffer area that from the mapping process, we're still doing that, and we have good, we've done the research to see why that is appropriate. And so we have the background information on that. Now, there was a question in the RMP, and a question as to whether there was, in another part of the RMP, it referred to that area as a review area. So the question before the council, as we had a long debate on that, was indeed the consideration of it as a review area. Since we've met with you on that topic, we, both ourselves and the consultants, we've done some back and forth work on that and research into vernal pools. And so what I'd like to do is just read for you. The goal is protection and enhancement of critical wildlife habitats, significant natural areas, and vernal pools. The policy underneath that is protect and promote the biodiversity of vernal pools through assignment of a terrestrial habitat protection buffer of 1,000 feet around vernal pools to address the habitat requirements of vernal pool breeding wildlife. And the objectives, we have three under this policy. A vernal pools buffer may be rebutted if existing land uses present a human, natural, or development barrier to vernal pool breeding wildlife. The next objective, a vernal pools buffer may be rebutted if vernal pool breeding wildlife identified at a site do not require the 1,000-foot habitat buffer. And the last objective, prohibit adjustments and revisions to vernal pool protection buffers other than in the aforementioned two objectives, except as necessary to protect public health and safety or to provide for minimum practical use with required mitigation, including a habitat protection buffer in addition to mitigation, in the absence of any alternative through issuance of a waiver by NJDEP or the Highlands Council. Those are the ones I think that in this portion under this that we'd like you to focus on to see if they meet your requirements in terms of what we discussed at the last at that meeting when we discussed vernal pools.
I'd like to hold off on that particular item, Mr. Chairman, with you. Since Kurt seemed to have the strongest and most violent objection to open your proposal, I would like to have it included in the discussion before any changes are made.
Well, is he expected to be
here?
Kurt did tell me he had difficulties because, and he had asked, you know, because the difficulty, because of his farmstead and what he needs to be doing at this time of year, they do tours. However, I did offer to him that at a time of his choosing, and I would be glad to go to his place of business if he wished, that I would take him through this document and through the discussion that ensued today. So I just want to let you know that I've made that offer to him if he wasn't able to be here today. So if you, however you wish to handle it, but remember there's no...
I'm not sure of the schedule of the next meeting either. I think it'd be good to get other council members' opinions about this, the changes you proposed and you're on the table. We're not actually deciding anything today. We'll decide it when we vote on the draft final, but and whatever is next year, we'll make sure we have an opportunity for this on the agenda again.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question? Having dealt with vernal pools at the municipal level, when we were trying to build a park and discovered that they existed there, I have a question that, and it's a technical question, I don't expect you to answer, but is it possible in any way to mitigate these, to find another place to put them or whatever, such as we do with wetlands and all? I don't know that you can answer that, but I know if we had had these restrictions in place and our municipality had gone into conformance, we wouldn't have been able to go to park. So.
Well, I think what we've done here is, I don't believe there's any suggestion of moving of the features. I think rather what it is a genuine review of what is in existence in that vernal pool. If in cases, for example, and what I was hoping to do is at a future meeting bring visuals to you where you can see that there are vernal pools that exist in pristine areas of the Highlands, and at the same time there are vernal pools that are in areas where a great deal of development has already occurred, so that we could show you that in cases such as that there may be impediments to the 1,000-foot area in terms of development roads that exist. And then, therefore, the applicant has the ability to do a study of the area so that they could rebut the 1,000-foot buffer for good reason. And so I think that's what we attempt to get to here.
Those animals have to stay in Kurt's basement.
Yeah. Kurt moves them, he's on his own. He's not getting any staff assistance.
Staff is an expert on this.
Aaron Lyman.
I would like to learn more.
Aaron Lyman has been doing our work and research on that. If you'd like to hear from Aaron.
Let me go back to Jack's comment a minute, Eileen. If you're going to have visuals to show us about this in a subsequent meeting, maybe we should postpone this discussion until we can all see
I
that.
Agree.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say I think that this does bring our policy more in line with threatened and endangered species review and restrictions, and I think it's a good attempt at trying to make sure that we're not taking too heavy a hand. But we have to remember that these vernal pools are very special habitats. It's practically impossible to recreate them. The studies that have been done by the state on recreation of wetlands shows that 85% are a failure of created wetlands. Done by New Jersey DEP themselves. So, I mean, I think we really just have to recognize that there are some very, very special habitats attached to the Highlands, and we need to protect them, or they're going to go away. And if the science says 1,000 feet, then I think what we're doing here is saying, hey, we're recognizing what the science says, this is what these animals need, and if there's some rebuttal to that based on what's actually on the ground, then we'll consider it. And I think this goes a long way towards making sure we're not being draconian in our approach.
Well, it's certainly better.
And Mimi, what Aaron did do research into this to come up with these policies and goals, and then ran it through other staff review. But Aaron did the research on this. You know, it was a well-researched topic, both on looking at vernal pools and the vernal pools that had impediments in the sense of developed areas around them. And that's how she came to it. Recommending these particular goals, policies, and objectives to us.
All right, so let's put this aside to come back to before we end up approving the draft.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to ask some questions before we put it aside.
Okay. I was suggesting we have a full discussion about it at a subsequent meeting when we have the presentation that I later referred to. If you have questions, would be helpful now, go ahead.
But just along the terminology, I also think it strikes a pretty good balance. And you know, my question is, when you say rebut, do you mean modify? In other words, if there's a development within that 1,000-foot area, and clearly the zone the review zone or the protection zone will be modified, not necessarily rebutted, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Rebutted.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think modified would be a better word. Yeah.
Tom, would you accept modified?
Well, I think we can work with that language, but okay. The buffer itself would be modified as a result of the conclusion that we agreed with their presentation.
Rebuttal.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I mean, a rebuttal is not necessarily a done deal. Just because you rebut an argument doesn't mean that the rebuttal is accepted. So,
Well, I think the construct comes out of the idea that there's a map, a designated zone based on some analysis that we've done, and that it can be ground truthed, and that there's a rebuttable presumption. So you can go in and demonstrate that the area encompassed in that protection zone should be modified because the animal either doesn't require that entire area, or it's not present, or there's some significant impairment, already existing. I think that's my understanding of it. So I want to be clear that what we're talking about is acknowledging real-world situations and modifying protection, not rebutting it, not saying, no, there's a road there or a building there, the zone doesn't exist at all.
So it's a rebuttable presumption that the review zone is correct,
right?
And if we accept the analysis, it will be modified.
Right.
Okay, then we can make sure the language is clarified.
Right. I mean, when it says a vernal pool buffer may be rebutted, you could read that as saying eliminated. And
okay.
In fact, it means lessened.
Can I just have one further comment? So if we found that the vernal pool did not have any critical habitat in it anymore, would you still have to adhere to the DEP restrictions? They have got fairly significant buffer restrictions. That's just a comment. I want to know. For the next time.
That's why we did mention through issuance of a waiver by NJDEP or the Highlands Council. So definitely where they have regulatory authority,
they have
regulatory authority.
If I may, we're also using the DEP method and relying on the DEP method for designation of a vernal habitat. So if the department finds that that is no longer operating as a vernal habitat, then it's no longer a vernal pool. You know? So it's that kind of issue. We're only dealing with DEP designated vernal pools.
Okay, then we're moving on to the next subject, which is open space. And on this topic, I did want to let you know that we did have, when we sent this out to the state agencies, we did receive comments back from Green Acres, which were really seeking for us to clarify the roles from and how we work together. And so those are included in. And in particular, one thing they did ask us to include in is when we're talking about forest preservation, the forest preservation easement program, when you utilize Green Acres monies, there's a requirement for public access. I mean, however, that does not have to be public access throughout the whole site. It can be a limited public access. But points like that, they asked us to add to this, and we did. Open space public and private investment in land preservation over the years has protected nearly a third of the Highlands region as perpetual open space. And remembering what we were reminded at our last meeting by Councilman Jack Schreier, we do commend the many municipalities and the counties for the great work they have done in protecting the Highlands, and that is why we have this large degree of protected area within the region. Open space preserves natural and recreational lands, ecosystem integrity, and the protection of drinking water supplies. The Highlands Act contemplates preservation of additional open space resources. As a result, preservation of open space provides compensation to landowners. And of course, this all goes to community character as well. Open space can be, in the form of pocket parks within more developed areas and allows for public access to those and the enjoyment of all for the investment of the funds. It also has the other goals, and in the more open space areas, some of the protections that we speak to here are afforded through open space preservation.
Thank you for that, Max. I appreciate that. Can Eileen be heard at the back of the room?
No.
Well, that's a first.
I see a lot of quizzical expressions as you were speaking, and it's not your fault. It's, I think, a function of the sound system.
No, I'm just speaking to the microphone.
If I speak into the microphone, is it better?
Yes.
I apologize. What I had done was I had read the open space introduction. I had commended the municipalities and counties on the good work, and of course the state, on the good work that has been done on preservation within the Highlands, which has led to that nearly third of the region being protected. And then I spoke to the what's on the screen, the different advantages to the protection of open space. And that leads us to the goals. I had also referred to the fact that we had gotten information and comments from Green Acres that just sought for us to clarify some of the goals and policies to make sure that we're consistent with the approach taken by Green Acres.
The goals are the protection of critical resources through the preservation of open space throughout the Highlands region. Again, preserving open space is not just in the preservation area, it's important to the entire region and all of its communities. Obviously, conforming municipalities and counties include open space preservation and land stewardship programs in their master plan and development regulations. That's a goal. It's largely achieved, but we want to enhance it. And then finally, promoting the preservation of forests and private ownership through the creation of a forest preservation easement program. This is largely, with the exception of the comments from the state agencies, what was in the prior document. It was not all in one section, however. All right. Now we go to part two, which is water resources and water utilities. The Highlands Regional Master Plan addresses five fundamental issues with regard to water. Availability of water resources for human and ecological use, protection of the water resource availability, protection, restoration, and enhancement, very important, of water quality, the management of land development patterns and densities to ensure that the carrying capacity of the water resources are not exceeded, and finally, the cost-effective and efficient provision and use of water utility capacity in a manner that ensures compatibility with the carrying capacity of the water resources, in other words, sustainable. There are a series of goals that fall under that. They're relatively long statements, but because of the centrality of the issue of water, they include material that's in the Act itself to make it very clear what the goals are. The protection of the value of the Highlands region as, quote, an essential source of drinking water, providing clean and plentiful drinking water for one half of the state's population. Two, along with, and importantly, the ecological values of clean water through protection, enhancement, restoration of water resources, quantity, flow characteristics, and quality as fundamental to ensuring that there are adequate water supply to support these needs. The second policy is protection, restoration, enhancement of water quality and quantity of surface and groundwater. Again, restoration and enhancement, which is critical both to remediate existing conditions, but also to the future redevelopment potential of many parts of our the region. And determine the amount and type of human development and activity which the ecosystem of the Highlands region can sustain while still maintaining those twin values. Overall ecological integrity and with special reference to surface water, groundwater quality and supply, quantity and quality. Again, invoking the references from the statute. Right. We want to bring to your attention a discussion. We've had prior conversation about the thresholds in the three management areas, and the prior document addresses the mitigation equal to 125% of new consumption in deficit water watershed subwatersheds. Included in this document is a concept of conditionally providing water availability within current deficit areas. In the planned community zone, that conditional net water availability of 2% is based on low flow margin method conditioned upon prior implementation or commitment for implementation of the 125% requirement. And in the protection or conservation zone, the availability of a 1% groundwater capacity. That is to recognize that implementation of this mitigation program takes time. And that there are maybe community opportunities and needs in the interim, and a very marginal a conditional availability of threshold is proposed. And I think we've received some comments about whether the prudence or appropriateness of that policy, and that's why we've brought it, called it out to your special attention.
The November 30th draft did not allow for any availability of water in areas that were in deficit. And so this is a change from that, and so that's why we're, again, calling it out to you.
Mr. Chair, I guess I think I brought that point up, but I'm still concerned about the logic of why, as a matter of policy, we would allow exacerbation of deficits. I understand that you're proposing this idea that there'd be a mitigation as a prerequisite, a condition of it. I think we talked about a little bit about whether or not there's any track record or success stories out there to show that those mitigation approaches actually can work. So I think that the more prudent approach is to be very, very conservative in watersheds that we know are in deficit and not to allow overdrawing or drawing beyond that capacity. I have a question about the way the timing would work. Is the suggestion that we would grant or authorize or recommend the allowing the allocations to happen contingent upon the mitigation, or would we require the mitigation to happen first, which seems to me would bring, if it's successful, bring the watershed out of deficit and then allow them to propose to consume whatever surplus is created by that mitigation?
Currently written, it says prior implementation or commitment for implementation. Now, when we discussed as a staff the 125% mitigation, Dan assured me that he will be able to give us a case study of where this was successful. And so if he's able to do that at the October 18th meeting to give us a case where this has been successful, I'd ask him to do that for you. But currently written, it's prior to or that commitment.
Which policy is that language?
It's policy objective 212, 51, and 52.
I think, Tim, in the
page 19.
To be straightforward about it, I think the concept is that you create an incentive for adopting and implementing a mitigation program by preloading a very small amount of the threshold. That's the concept, and I think it's a subject of some considerable importance because of the amount of the number of lands in the planned community area which are in deficit right now, and that's of course where we're trying to promote redevelopment, use of TDRs, and so that's a tension that we have been internally discussing at some length, and that's just, I think it's an important policy issue. And I do think that Dan's ability to demonstrate the feasibility of the water conservation or mitigation program is really critical to whether this is a prudent policy or not.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Again, I support that idea that to the extent that we've identified these deficit areas, and particularly where those deficit areas coincide with places we would like to direct growth to based on the existing landscape, then we ought to be actively managing the water resources to take them out of deficit. I'm very concerned about the idea of commitments because I think the track record in New Jersey is that there's lots of promises made to condition variances from particularly environmental policies and that never come through. So it's very much important to me, I think, that we structure this program so that we resolve the problem first before we allow any what I would call overdrawing on that resource go forward.
With respect to Mr. Dillingham's comments, and I don't disagree with them. I think that we have an obligation to do both things. I think that we can accept a commitment and make sure that the commitment will be followed through upon. So I don't see that as a complete obstacle going forward. And as a deficit in a HUC is a deficit in a watershed, not necessarily site specific. So I think there are ways to get around all of this, and I think that we're approaching it.
Mr. Chair,
I just wanted to respond. I do think that the, sometimes you overlook. I think implementation or commitment is not a very good characterization of the threshold we have in mind. So I think your observation on that is very well taken, and we'll address that, I think.
I understand the policy, which I agree, but the this would, somebody could be granted approval, and by the mitigation would still leave the region in deficit. It would make it the situation less worse.
No, I think there would be a commitment to mitigation, and that we, in effect, we're offering an incentive of preloading. There would be an additional potential deficit that would be created during an MRIM period, but it would be granted only with the understanding that in some acceptable period of time, that mitigation will be a fact, and that the net benefit will be achieved.
But the hub would still be in deficit.
It could still be
in deficit, but no worse.
Right.
In fact, it will be, should be better.
I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot by allowing additional withdrawals in areas that are already in deficit. And I think I think we definitely should be putting emphasizing with municipalities how important it is that that they make efforts to decrease how much that deficit is. But I agree with what Tim is saying. The timing is all important here. I don't think we can really afford to have periods of time where we're continuing a deficit or possibly making it worse because we don't know whether the mitigation measures are effective or not. And I think we should really move ahead with the mitigation or, you know, efforts to try to reduce these deficit areas first and put into the period of time after we adopt the plan a revisiting of areas to see how well that's working in order to then perhaps consider this, you know, modest 1 and 2% that you're talking about. I also wanted to comment on the table, which is under objective, it's the groundwater.
Page 17,
groundwater availability thresholds. And because Dan was very helpful through passing information through Eileen to me and is trying to sort out how this actually differs from what we discussed in our policy discussions two meetings ago and what was in the draft plan. It's a little confusing, and I appreciate that. But I still have a question about the existing constrained area where it says 5% plus of the 2003 depleted and consumptive under conservation and planned community zone. Can you explain that? Am I understanding it correctly in that what we had established in the draft was that the depleted and consumptive use would be subtracted from the low flow margin of safety, and then the percent would be added on after that? And are we reversing that now?
And I'll ask Dan to respond to that.
No, it's. I thought about putting in an actual formula and decided against it. Maybe I should anyway. The idea is you start out with the standard threshold, whatever it is, 5, 10, 15, 20%. And in normal situations, you would subtract the existing consumptive depleted use and you would wind up with a net. Well, these areas are upstream of deficit areas, and so they're going to be a little bit more constrained. And basically what it says is that you take the existing depleted consumptive use. Let's say you have a 20% area. They're right now at 10% depleted and consumptive. Instead of being able to go to 20, they would only be able to go to 15. Let's say you have another area that's 20%, and they're already at 18%. They would be able to go to 20%, not to 23. So okay. No matter what, you stop at the standard threshold.
All right. Thank you.
If I'm sorry, if I can just, I don't think we're shooting ourselves in the foot on this issue at all. I think that we have to do the right thing here. And I think if we're going to prohibit flat out any more depleted uses, despite a commitment to restore, then I think that we are just essentially stopping all development. And I don't think that's our objective or our goal. We want to be helpful extent that we can while doing the job that the act requires us to do.
Let me ask Tracy or Tim, are you suggesting that the language in this proposed draft should be changed, or are you suggesting that we pay special attention to the implementation sections when we get to that?
I suggested in my edits a change to the language.
Which is not reflected here,
right?
And so I guess we ought to get a sense the council whether the majority of members feel it should be changed or are comfortable going forward with it as here, again, recognizing we can vote formally to change anything when we get to that point with the whole draft in front of us.
I appreciate that because I think it does require a vote. And I, if you want to, I can say what my language change was.
Okay,
under 21241.
Why don't you do with pages?
Page 19. It's the second objective from the top, I believe. Is it still? Okay, now it's changed. Sorry, it's now at the bottom of 18. Okay, what I suggested is that, but if you look at that number, 21241, it's still the same number, I believe.
There are actually two, there are two that are numbered the same.
Okay, one should say, the second one should say two. I'm talking about the first one, I believe. Oh, no,
go to the second one.
Okay, it's changed. My proposed wording change is proposed increases in water use, including consumptive and depletive water uses within a current deficit area or existing constrained area, shall, cross everything out, be prohibited unless approved by the Highlands Council to address a demonstrated need to protect public health and safety.
So what I heard, I think, in the conversation so far was Jack disagree with that. Jim might agree with it.
That's a fair representation of my position. Thank you.
Sort of like to ask for just a straw vote, but are there any... Anybody would like to say anything about this before we...
I do think that part of our responsibility is, under the Act, is to set development policy in a way that reflects the carrying capacity of the region. And that's, in essence, what the Master Plan is supposed to do. We're not bound to promote development or to allow development or to be adverse to stopping development when it's not sustainable under this Act. I guess part of what I was suggesting, Mr. Chairman, was not just the implementation question, but was the fundamental policy, which could be influenced by demonstrating that the implementation is strong. But I think it's probably the better position to take to do it the way Tracy has proposed, and then modify the rest of the section to figure out how to promote those active mitigation projects, whether that's investment in infrastructure or otherwise.
I'm sure to no one's surprise, I agree with Jack's efforts at a balance here.
No, I think that we have to keep in mind that we're going to have to sell this plan to communities in the planning area. And I honestly believe that while leaving this exception in there, that if they mitigate and compensate, that they can continue to do some development in deficit areas. That will absolutely encourage them to enter into different kind of conservation programs. But I think that we should also suggest within the plan recommended conservation methods that will encourage them.
And that gets to the programs, Mimi. We would definitely have programs that offer opportunities for restoration, mitigation, and that new development would meet new standards that wouldn't be as depletive as the old standards.
Some of the areas where we're going to maybe want to implement TDR, we might find that unless we have these exceptions, we won't be able to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like clarification from Eileen and from Charlie on the implication of changing the language as Tracy refers it. What do you see as the implication here?
Well, I think the impact is, Tim really stated, it's a public policy set that says where you have an existing deficit, you don't increase it. You don't make it worse, period. And that if there is a conservation program put in place so that the deficit is reduced, then that capacity, I think then there would be a public policy decision about even whether you maintain the existing deficit or you really want to go further in and reduce it and leave it reduced. We've suggested that the alternative, which has been suggested, is that we want to induce mitigation programs. We wanted to induce water use conservation. And there are a variety of techniques. I mean, some of it can be where wastewater treated water is being discharged could have a significant effect on the particular status of a particular subwatershed. And that if you don't have a chicken, you never get the egg. And sometimes, because this is, we're depending so much on the purple areas, to use that definition, for focusing and guiding development, and many of the purple areas are in current deficit areas. So that our ability to increase, accommodate TDRs. So there's this balance, and I think, from my perspective, I would like to see the final decision on this be made in the context of the programs. I do think there's some changes. I would not recommend that we keep the ambiguous language of impairment or commitment. I think it has to be pretty strong, and it has to be science-based, that there's a high degree of probability before you start advancing any additional deficit, no matter how modest. And I believe that we can do that, but I think we'll only prove that, frankly, with the showing that Eileen's described, that Dan will make, and the programs, because I think this is one where the devil is really in the detail.
So are there other members of the council who would at this point want to ask that the language be changed to the way Tracy suggested? Not we can lead up this way and we'll certainly have a lot of details to deal with.
We have a lot of work to do.
I just wanted to, one last thing to think about as we move forward is I would argue that it's even more than an inducement to say that, hey, you're in deficit, and you're not going to be able to use any more water until you improve it. And then that will really make the program move ahead. And I would just argue that that is would have even more of a impact towards us seeing effective programs to remediate these deficit areas.
Just one comment. Right.
Don, if I may comment, I just want to...
Just a minute, Debbie. Bill?
I support what you're saying, but I absolutely disagree with that. I think any time that you set a policy to penalize people, what you get is cheating. You don't get compliance. I think when you induce people to change and you push it forward, you get compliance. And I think as a matter of public policy, whether it's this or municipal or county government, that we err every time that we create a prohibitive act that has no way for people to be induced to change. So I would not want to change it.
Just an example of what can be accomplished with conservation efforts. When we implemented simple limited lawn watering in Precipity, we saved on some days during the summer 2 to 3 million gallons a day. And that's a significant amount of water. So an awful lot can be accomplished by coming up with good conservation techniques.
Don, may I comment?
Yes.
I agree with much of what Tim and Tracy said. I'm not going to repeat it. And as to conservation, we should be recommending all of those things. I think that's the serious flaw in the Act that it did not specifically address that, and we should, but I don't think we should rely on that. I think we need to keep our eye on the ball, which is the primary goal of the Act, and I think that primary goal supports Tim and Tracy's comments.
And let me also, for Debbie's sake, acknowledge that Eric Peterson has joined us as well.
And with that note, John, I'm sorry, I had that conflict.
Okay, and Eric has joined us to take Scott's place.
Thank you.
Okay. Sure, back to you.
That was the singular issue within this subpart that we wanted to bring to your attention.
And now we move to protection of water resources quality. Quantity. The Highlands Regional Master Plan focuses on a variety of measures to protect the replenishment of water resources in the Highlands region through groundwater recharge and other means to ensure the maintenance of aquatic ecosystems and human water uses. And on the screen here you can see the goals underneath this particular topic. Continuation of refinement to the Regional Master Plan with regard to water resource supply, maintenance of hydrologic integrity through the protection of groundwater recharge, and improvement of groundwater recharge through regional management efforts. And I believe this is very close to the November 30th draft.
There have been some clarifications made, but I think the ultimate substance is the same.
I don't know, month 27, that's part 3. Are you going to talk about that as well as protection?
Yes, that's next.
That's under the next heading.
So we'll move along.
Okay,
this is water. The last was water quantity. This is water quality. The Highlands Regional Master Plan focuses on a variety of measures to protect, enhance, and restore, as necessary, the quality of water resources in the Highlands region to ensure that human and ecological water uses have water quality appropriate to those uses, and that human water uses do not alter water quality in unacceptable ways. And then again on the screen you have the goals, assessment and restoration of surface and groundwater quality of the Highlands region, protection, restoration and enhancement of the water quality of the region, and limitation of the type and amount of human development in the wellhead protection areas of public water supply wells.
A comment on that. DEP, I know, is a very specific municipal ordinance that they ask you to adopt. They modified that. It's a fairly lengthy process. And having had some experience in that, I think that we ought to, where we can, call out activities such as gas stations and generators or other items that we don't want in the wellhead protection area, and to try and get that adoption, at least so that it's consistent with the recommendation that the DEP gives the municipalities today.
Chester and Parsippany, I think, were the first towns in New Jersey to implement wellhead protection ordinances. And they kind of differ because theirs focused more on individual wells, whereas ours focused on municipal wells. But one of the weaknesses of these, particularly with one protecting their municipal wells, is we could do fine establishing the wellhead protection area and what things that, you know, and the area is different for different types of potential contaminants. But when we had a well that was near a neighboring community, then we lost all ability to deal with that. And so that's something that really has to be considered, how we cross municipal boundaries.
By the way, our issue was really with the municipal. We have a couple of MUAs in town, and that was our issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
Our ability to control within that zone once across the municipal boundary.
Yep. And that's an appropriate issue for the regional MUA, if there is one, to deal with. And Mr. Schweitzer's gone, I think, but the Morris County MUA is very active in expanding the water protection area of land acquisition. We have a very aggressive program.
But it would be something maybe that the county level would want to do something.
This is a change of use that was going to come into an intervention area, so it's not a matter of purchasing prohibiting. But just in an overall, if we're looking at this, if you're looking at this, I mean, you ought to be looking at it within that consistency of that, you know, recommended DEP,
right,
so that it's consistent.
I have a question on that section.
Yes.
Hard to figure the pages, but it's 23322, which I believe is 28. Okay, 28. Just a question on those objectives, talking about the tiers and what can happen in the tiers. Why don't we say, for instance, under 2, where we're talking about what you can't do in tier 2, why doesn't it say tier 1 and 2? Because because tier 1 is the closest, then tier 2, and then tier 3. So it would stand to reason that the things that you can't do in Tier 1, you also, when you say you can't do them in these other things in Tier 2, you also couldn't do those things in Tier 1 because they would degrade the water quality even more if you did those persistent organic chemical sources and these other problems, if you introduce those problems in the Tier 1. So,
okay, Tracy, first in answer to your comment, we did add another objective. It's 23313, so it's above that, and it was just to clarify the wellhead protection areas, the three tiers. And
yeah, I saw that.
So I did want to first draw attention to that to say that, and so that everybody following in the audience can follow that, there are three tiers for wellhead protection area. The time of travel for groundwater to the well in Tier 1 is 2 years, in Tier 2, 5 years, and in Tier 3, 12 years. And then I'd ask Dan to respond, because we spoke this morning in response to your suggestion that we would add Tier 1 to that objective.
Very simply, Tier 2 is everything from 0 to 5 years' time of travel. Tier 3 is everything from 0 to 12 years' time of travel. So if you think of it, there, it's almost like a nested dolls kind of thing where there are overlays to each other.
Okay, as long as Tier 2 includes Tier 1, then I'm
yes, it does.
Okay.
And maybe we'd clarify that in the earlier objective. So that
yeah, I think if it's made a little clearer, that would
be good. So we'll do that.
And the same with Tier 3 then.
Yes,
right.
Thank you.
Are you okay on that?
Yeah, I think.
Okay, the next heading is sustainable development and water resources.
Yes.
The Highlands Regional Master Plan focuses on a variety of measures to ensure that future development is at densities necessary to remain within the carrying capacity of water resources for both quality and quantity, and to ensure that water supply and wastewater utility capacities are made available in ways that provide maximum regional benefit within the constraints of water availability and water quality protection, and are used in ways that provide cost-effective and efficient service. And then following are the goals: limitation of the expansion of water and wastewater infrastructure in the preservation area, all existing and future development in the Highlands region that utilises public water supply systems served by adequate and appropriate infrastructure, and all existing and future development in the Highlands region that uses public wastewater treatment systems served by adequate and appropriate infrastructure. This pretty much follows the November 30th draft. What I would call your attention to, though, is, I'm just checking the pages here, is we do establish in these goals, policies and objectives the nitrate target area for new development reliant on septic systems, both within the protection zone and the conservation zone. And just checking to see where that is in your, on the page. Thank you. Thanks. It's page 35, and the objectives are 2, 4, 4, 2, 1, so it's close to the top of the page. It's about 1, 2, 3, 4 down. And objective 2, 4, 4, 2, 2, and I'll read those. Use the median concentrations of nitrate in groundwater for planning area hub 14 subwatersheds, where the protection zone is predominant, as a nitrate target for new development reliant on septic systems within the protection zone. The median is 0.81 milligrams per litre. And in terms of the conservation zone, again, use the median concentrations of nitrate in groundwater for planning area HUC 14 subwatersheds, where the conservation zone is predominant, as the nitrate target for new development reliant on septic systems within the conservation zone. The median is 1.88 milligrams per litre. Now, this is consistent with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection approach, which established the median for New Jersey on a statewide basis as 2 milligrams per litre. They also used this analysis or this methodology when they looked at the preservation area. So we took the medians for the HUC 14s. We will be, and I just wanted to make sure you realise that we will be doing more work on this and bringing back more information to you at the next two meetings, October 18th and again November 1st. November 1st, when it focuses on the lands map, will focus on capacity issues. But we'll be bringing, again, more information to you on October 18th. And I say that because what we want to do is looking at this on a HUC 14 level, using these target zones to deliver to the council what this would mean in terms of added septics. And if using that approach gives the opportunity then to work with municipalities as to how they would wish to apportion those, offering them that sort of flexibility. In other words, if they're given a number of septics, that they might consider how best to plan for those communities to, if they're going to have growth, where to guide that growth. So it would be a partnership. That's the direction we're taking. Of course, it's subject to review and direction from this council. But the first step is to establish the target.
and that's what we've done here.
The density is reflected in the conservation zone in hundredths of a liter, milligrams per liter. Is there any plus or minus in that? I mean, would 1.88, would 1.89 be acceptable under certain conditions?
I think this is Dan's question.
Dan, would you like to answer that?
Oh, I would love to answer that. The figure that you're seeing is a median of all of the subwatershed medians, and so it comes out to be a mathematical result.
Where is that?
The number is actually going to change based on which subwatershed you're dealing with. So those kinds of issues do come in, but that is the median. We did bring it down to a hundredths, and it plugged into a formula. It didn't make sense to go to 10,000ths, but we did leave it at hundredths just because that's fairly typical.
Thank you, Chairman.
Let me just say one thing. Yeah. The introduction sentence, just the first sentence, I'll give you this in the market, but I think what's meant, or at least to be clear of me, is to say includes a variety of measures to ensure that future development does not exceed densities necessary to remain within the carrying capacity rather than is at densities.
Where are you, sir?
In the introduction.
In the introduction, the top part on the screen. But, to say does not exceed densities rather than is at densities.
Okay, yes, we'll correct that. And Tracy, before you speak, I just want to show that we did due diligence and due deference to your comments. You did express concern about when I talked to the number of septics that would be available, let's just say in a HUC 14, using these targets, that then we would work with the community in terms of where those septics would be utilised, in other words, where they would guide the growth. And Tracy did raise an issue with us, a concern about pollutant levels, if clustering was used, what, you know, the damage could be potentially there. And so how do you judge it on a site-by-site analysis, and how do you look at that clustering, and how do you protect? So we did respond to that in added, and I want to make sure you've seen them, Tracy, two objectives. Page 35 of mine, I want to make sure it's the same. Bottom of 35, and those two objectives are, and these are new residential development utilizing septic systems where lot size averaging, clustering, or open space subdivision design techniques are employed shall have a gross density for all parcels involved in the development proposal based on the nitrate dilution target appropriate for the zone. But with the density for the developed portion of the site based on a nitrate dilution target not to exceed 10 milligrams per litre. And this is again consistent with the approach by New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Further, in the next objective, we said new residential development utilising septic systems shall be designed in a manner that minimises the risk of well contamination, because Tracy drew this to our attention as well, due to the flow of septic system plumes within or between developed lots, addressing general groundwater flow patterns, major fracture systems, and other appropriate geological, geophysical, and hydrogeological issues. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, Tracy, but I did want to show you that we were responding.
I greatly appreciate that. And 2.6 then means that with each development coming in, that development will have to meet the nitrate dilution target not to exceed 10, or would it be 2?
Dad.
For the gross site, the initial site from within, you know, within which it's being clustered, will have to meet the zone target. So that would be 0.81 or 1.88. And then for the developed portion of the site, the cluster, if you will, it would have to make sure that it does not exceed 10. So it's a double target.
Okay. That does help. It's a little bit of a belt and suspenders thing that I had brought up. But I just wanted to say that I think there's a lot of issues here that we need to get into, perhaps a whole meeting really focused on the nitrate dilution and the septic density issue. And I did send a memo to Eileen discussing several problems I have with the way that this is all going to be applied. And I think looking at just what's in the GPO, we really can't appreciate how it's going to be applied. And the issues of, you know, what it, exactly what is the drought numbers that are going to be used? How are they derived? I have a problem with using the New Jersey DEP GS 32 model in order to derive the drought figures, because I would suggest that rather than it being two-thirds, it might be 50% of the flow. And I think that these issues are things that are not included in the GPO, so I don't think we should discuss them today. But I think that these are critical issues, and we need to really explore them in depth. And I, you know, have further talked about my concerns in the memo that I sent related to the how we apply this on the site-by-site basis as well. And also my concern that by using the median, I understand we have to arrive to it on a figure, and we have to agree that, well, this is fair. And median's definitely better than average, I agree. But what are we doing to protect the pristine areas that are below that 0.8 milligrams per liter level? Those are the most pristine areas in the highlands. And what we're really saying is that you can degrade those. And I don't see any provisions here that actually protects our most highest quality waters. The same thing in the conservation zone. If you then you can go up to 1.81, and even if your background is less. Now I hear what you're saying, that we need to, you know, look at the HUC 14, and that it may be adjusted based on the HUC 14. But I think we really need to explore that in depth and discuss, you know, how we're going to do that practically, and how it plays out in terms of having a level playing field, having consistent application of these targets across the Highlands region. So I just think this is a huge issue. I don't think we can tackle it today, because the council doesn't have the benefit of you know, discussing the memo, which I appreciate the draft memo, because that helps a lot, and we did get it in our packets. But I think we really need to focus on the details in that memo before we buy into the GPOs in this section.
Okay. You're saying, Tracy, that we shouldn't discuss this today, but I'm trying to figure out when we should discuss it.
And that's what I spoke to when I said that we would be having October 18th, some further work on this, and November 1st, because on November 1st with the lands map, we expect to do a lot of the capacity issues. So, I know Tracy said one full meeting. We're a little short on meetings, but we had proposed in talking with staff and with our consultant to do two further studies on this. We've done a lot of in-house work on this and research, and a lot of trial and errors to make sure we ground test these approaches through and through. And what I did include in your package, the ongoing memo, and that was to give you some analysis of, so that you could see how we got to these particular numbers. But that draft is not complete. And the memo that Tracy had spoken to, there were two memos, one that was on GPOs, in which I did respond to here. The other memo I received this morning, so I haven't even sent it to...
I emailed that out last night, but yeah. I have...
you were just referring to is the one you emailed out there. I mean, maybe that.
Yes, I emailed that out, and I can send it to all the council.
And I haven't shared it with staff yet either. Yeah. But you can anticipate having two further discussion periods on this work.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, relative to that matter, Tracy just elaborated. I think that memos going to Eileen that deal with issues that are going to come before the council really should be shared with the council. And perhaps we can ask Eileen, when you get some sort of a memo of that nature that you think is relevant to an issue that we will be discussing, can be distributed to the entire council, just so we know
that's great.
What the issue is. Give us a heads
that.
Up on it.
I'd be happy to do that. Yeah. And just to realize, though, that Jack, that's why many of the things that are brought to the attention of staff are, we bring them to your attention in these meetings as well, so that to make sure that the full council is involved in decisions. We don't change things unless we've, obviously, errors, omissions, that kind of thing, yes. But other than that, that's why this is a discussion that I've been drawing to your attention. Thanks for that. But I take your point.
Mr. Chairman,
I just want to. I do think she's trying to be responsive, and the memos are flying fast and furious, so we're all working late at night on this stuff. I do think that, as Charlie said, this is really one of those issues where the devil is really in the details about the technical parts of it, and that needs to be thought through. So there clearly are policy choices in those technical decisions that we ought to understand the implications of. For today, I have one general question, which is, in using the median values, Dan, again, Hucks, will that result in degradation in certain areas? I mean, are we establishing a policy that we're going to allow the degradation of water quality in certain parts of the region in order to accommodate the development under these targets?
This is not a simple answer, and my apologies for it. Non-degradation means no additional loading. Any additional septic systems is degradation. So from that perspective, any target that you choose for nitrate dilution modeling with regard to new septic systems will add loading to an area, and it will result in some, one hopes, fairly limited amount of potential for degradation. So that's the really broad answer to your question. The issue with regard to the second part of it, though, is that this is only being applied to the privately owned, undeveloped, non-preserved lands. And so if you have a pristine area, the odds are that that pristine area is pristine because it has been, not entirely, but a large chunk of it has been preserved, which means that you are automatically cutting back the number of new septic systems that you would be allowed drastically, basically proportional to the amount of land that's been preserved. So that's a critical policy piece of this as well. And it also, to the extent that there is an issue that gets raised, it provides an incentive for additional preservation, which the council has already said that it wants to see. So that's an issue. And then the final issue is with regard to the conservation zone sub-watersheds, the elevation that we're seeing in nitrate levels is primarily related to the existence of agriculture in those areas. And we know that farm practices have been proven over the last couple of decades. So it's very difficult to tell how much is legacy levels that eventually will move out of the system and how much of it is due to active agriculture. But we do expect that at least in the conservation zones, we will see sort of a counterbalancing. And with improved ag practices, we definitely should be able to see a counterbalancing of increased septic system loadings versus decreased agricultural loadings, and policies try to get to that in another portion of, in a different portion of the goals, policies, and objectives, we really focus on ag loadings. So, as I said, it's not a simple answer, but the most basic fundamental answer is that if you add a septic system, you are adding to the total loading of the sub-watershed.
Right. The nuance on that is, though, how many can you add? At what point do you degrade the water quality to where it conflicts with other goals, right? So, you're trying to quantify that set of target number, and that's really what I'm trying to get at is, because I think that's the policy decision of where do we set that allowable level of degradation? How far should it go? And I think in some of the earlier discussions you said, it'll never go beyond the water quality standard that you set. And so I'm trying to figure out sort of this anti-degradation idea of no measurable change versus no loads at all.
I don't have an easy answer for it because when you come right down to it, every standard is two parts. One is risk analysis and the other is risk tolerance. The risk analysis on this, you know, we're dealing with nitrate dilution models. There are very good aspects to those models. There are some significant assumptions that get made. We are working with USGS to try to improve our ability to do the risk analysis, but that information simply isn't available to us. Easily well into next year before we have a better sense of how to use it. So we use what we have. And then the next question is risk tolerance, knowing that any additional loading increases the risk, but then the question is it too much or not enough? And that is a policy decision. That's, you can't make that two sides.
Well, let's move on then.
Okay, I just wanted to add to this because Dan really referred to it in his analysis that the approach we're taking, though it's consistent with the DEP approach, actually ours is more protective, and one of the reasons for that, and we will get into it more, is because we didn't include the preserved lands in the analysis. So I just wanted to make it clear that we are more protective
even though we're using the same methodology. We have sort of nuances that are more protective because that goes with our mission. But again, you can expect more of this, a lot more of this, at the two next meetings. The next area is agricultural resources. Obviously, the Act speaks to ag viability and our duties in that area. Agriculture is an important part of the essential character of the Highlands region, region's culture, landscape and economy. Agriculture provides important economic benefits to the Highlands region in the form of agricultural production, land stewardship and in maintaining rural character. Loss of farmland and the associated erosion of rural character in some parts of the Highlands region underscore the importance of promoting and supporting agriculture. Primarily this follows the November 30th draft, and in we have worked closely with, again, with the Department of Agriculture in responding to their comments that we had received and all the other comments during the public comment period. If there was one area I would draw your attention to, because we did receive comments, was the inclusion of consideration of clustering, and in particular Tracy had brought to our attention and it's the objective is policy 332, which is 39. On the bottom of page 39. Mm-hmm. And the language we have in there is to prohibit the development of additional water and wastewater infrastructure in an agricultural resource area in a conservation zone, except where such additional infrastructure is necessary to address the needs of an existing public health concern, mandatory clustering or open space design development as approved by the Highlands Council. And Tracy expressed concerns with the mandatory clustering or open space design development language in that.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should just delete the words mandatory clustering or open space design development. And I'm just sort of perplexed. Where the heck did this come from? Was it from public comment? Or, I mean, this is totally new.
Well, part of it was because we talk about guiding growth to where to adjacent to where development has already occurred. So that there might be a case, for example, in the conservation zone where there's an opportunity to have a cluster adjacent to where that the where there already is that infrastructure, and so if in those cases such as that we could cluster there and use that infrastructure that's adjacent to it. So it was cases like that to provide for the ability to have clustering on those lands.
I think clustering on agricultural lands, right?
Yes.
I think this needs tremendous discussion because we spent a long, long time at prior meetings arguing this issue. And I thought our policy was set to say that pretty much what the Act says, in and adjacent to, not new water infrastructure in the conservation zone.
We do have the language in there as approved by the Highlands Council. So if that gave a level of confidence that in
but
a case...
Here on the bottom of page 39, goes up to the top of page 40, and the mandatory clustering text is there. Yes, I mean, there had been a line drawn that we are not going to be putting clusters and developments into the conservation zone unless that property is in and adjacent to existing water and sewer infrastructure, period.
And
the 80-20 policy also? Yes. The 80-20% policy is there. It's on, I believe it's page 37. Okay. And it's, so that policy remains.
Taking into consideration Tracy's comments and recognizing that sometimes less is more, I wonder if at the top of page 40 we could achieve the goal by taking out the in the middle of that first line and address needs, jumping right to as approved by the Highlands Council. Take out the language in between.
That's more open, I think.
Well, but it's consistent with what we are, what we have discussed, I think, and what we want to achieve. Sure, it will read as follows. Starting with page 39, the rivers and development of additional water and wastewater infrastructure in the agricultural resource area in a conservation zone, except where such additional infrastructure is necessary to address needs as approved by the Highlands Council.
Mr. Argus, I guess I would suggest that we ask the staff to put the existing language back in. I mean, we've already debated at length and agreed on it.
I think that, unless I'm reading it correctly, the prior language was new, expanded, and extended water and wastewater infrastructure shall not be authorized in the conservation zone unless approved by the Highlands Council. That's this document here. We added those specific narrowing conditions because we thought that was far too broad. I mean, that's...
I'm asking to go back to the broader language and leave it up to the council to make it.
And so just so... In context, where this language came from was very much in that vein.
You're not pulling the wool over our eyes. I see that. But I think it's an issue that we need
to... I'm not denying that it's an issue, but I'm just... We worked from this document, and we worked... We thought backwards.
Yeah, right. I see where you're what you're saying. I understand that. Yeah.
And this clustering... And there is a lot of language about in or adjacent to existing infrastructure. There is. We talked about this concern. I mean, we have, you know, this landscape doesn't have these nice straight lines. And if we have a parcel of land where we can preserve 80% of the agricultural land by clustering on a parcel of land, and it has to jump 150 feet or 100 feet to get to that cluster, that's going to be better than taking the farm out. And we're trying to strike a balance in this language.
I hear what you're saying. I would just say 150 feet is very different than what this sounds like. Where this sounds like, you know, going out there and putting clusters across the countryside. That's if the Highlands Council okays it.
This draft is only in the context of the prior language that had no limitations, just whatever you all decided on an ad hoc basis in that.
I think what I'd suggest is the staff go back and look at this and bring this one back, too. I mean, I think because we're certainly free to change anything that was in the draft, it was a draft.
Absolutely. I'm not in any way suggesting that this is not an appropriate subject. I just want everyone to, because it's important to know how we get to where we are, and that's why we're trying to track things. There may be some inconsistent language in the other parts of the draft.
I just want to figure out, because we had extensive debate about this, Charlie, and it was the language about adjacency. And I was looking in the utility section because I think maybe that's where it ended up. But the balancing act you talked about, you know, was this 80-20 on the site, and then as we debated in the context of Mansfield's wastewater management plan there, the council agreed to allow that balancing to be done across the entire amendment area. So it went from parcel to region. So, I mean, again, yes, John, perhaps we can re-debate everything, but we have...
I just have a question, Hal. Are we going to identify what an agricultural resource area is in some type of glossary or whatever?
Yes. And that is in the draft plan, but we can... Mm-hmm.
It's both a defined term and it is also a geographic entity identified in our resource system.
It might be helpful to have something up front.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we are gathering all those terms for a glossary within
the
document.
It's actually graphically portrayed in Article 2, and maybe a cross reference is appropriate to those geographic descriptions that are in Article 2, in a variety of areas.
Bill?
Yeah, I was on 318, second one down on page 38. I'm not sure I necessarily understand that. Is there a recognition in here of acceptable ag management practices as promulgated by the CABBs and SABCs, where farmers, you know, go in and say, is this the right way to do something? Yes, it is. And that would, in fact, be a best management practice? Or is there some recognition of the role of either of those organizations and what farmers are doing on their land? I think that's important because they get protection under the Right to Farm Act as a result of using those AMPs, and that we ought to be promoting the use of those AMPs in their production. And that covers, you know, density of livestock and how you plow and farm. And
how many horses per acre?
Yeah. Not that they're my favorite people right now, by the way, but I think they're addressed. I mean, I think it's appropriate. And I think that's important to it. It adds, an editorial note, I would have included also your policy 325, which says promote and enhance practices for stands and whatnot in both goal 3.1 and under 3.2. Because I think that's so critical to the viability of agriculture in the state that it needs to be. I mean, without it, it doesn't exist. You get open spaces and estates and scrub. And then finally, at the end, I'd like to see a requirement in conforming municipalities to adopt a right-to-farm ordinance, specifically. And there are a lot of model ordinances are out there that we can recommend, but that's one of the ways to control the activity in a positive way on farms and bring the municipalities in to...
That's interesting. Are you saying something different than with the last?
Well, it says in their master plan, they're specific. You don't have to have it in your. There's specific ordinances that grant the right to farm in a community, and it details out. It's in a lot of cases, if you don't have one, you can't get farmland preserved. But there's still municipalities that don't have right to farm ordinances, and it would be good to encourage that.
Okay. We use development regulations to be ordinances. So both.
But we can clarify that and certainly take your points into consideration. And in terms of the BMPs, we work with Department of Ag, with State Forestry as well. And so we'll continue to do that and make sure that we make that clearer in this. Okay. The next section is historical, cultural, archaeological, and scenic resources. This pretty much follows your November 30th draft, and you did see some more work has been done on this in terms of review, for site-specific review that Tim spoke of in his Natural Resources Committee chair report this morning. So I don't know if there's anything in there that we particularly have to highlight.
Have we done an inventory of historic and cultural resources? And
we have what's available through, you know, other state agencies, but what we have now is a system by which we can add to, and you can have nominations for, and that's what we have released for public comment, and that was very much in response to comments received.
And so we're going to include that in the RMP?
Yes, it will be included, but again, it will be an ongoing piece of work, obviously. We have. Right. Okay.
No, it's just not in the document. Okay.
And the next section is transportation. The Highlands Regional Transportation System. There are three small plane airport facilities within the Highlands region. It's served by 4 interstate highways, 8 state roads, and county and local roads. The region is served by 4 major commuter rail lines, and there are 24 stations on these lines, which are located within the Highlands region. There's limited intra-regional bus service within the Highlands region, however, particularly in Morris County and along the Route 78 and 80 corridors. There's extensive commuter service, which is provided by NJ Transit and by private operators. And then follow the goals in this section. We have, as you know, we talked to you in the policies and issues meeting that we had on the added indicators to the LANDS model of transportation. So a great deal of research and analysis has been done by staff on transportation issues. And also we've received on this goals, policies and objectives draft document comments from both New Jersey Transit and Department of Transportation, DOT.
It's interesting that we're talking about this issue and last evening. Someplace, and despite all of the accessibility of transportation and the highway availability.
Excuse me, I can't hear Jack's comment.
I'm sorry, Debbie. I said that it's interesting that we're discussing this. And last evening, when I was going someplace, and I happened to get onto Route 10, and I was approaching the Powder Mill area, which Mayor Letts knows about very well, and construction is going on to improve that intersection of Powder Mill Road and Route the traffic was so far backed up that you couldn't move 10 feet in half a minute. And yes, the infrastructure is there, but the infrastructure often gets impeded. This is just a gratuitous comment.
I was going to ask what section you were in. <That's right. laughs>
This is an event. So I'm banging on the steering wheel for a few minutes. That's all.
I had the same experience the night before that.
Any other changes to the transportation section?
The only thing I would add is that there is a significant emphasis in the goals, policies, and objectives on transportation towards promoting intra-Highlands region movement of services, people and goods and services, and drawing a distinction between that and improvements that would convey traffic through the Highlands and giving priority consideration to that.
It'll be better when it's completed.
Yeah. It always is, Jack.
I just comment that the Morristown Airport does not accommodate just the small planes anymore. They're getting pretty big.
Small and getting bigger planes.
Ever-increasing size.
The next section is future land use. The Highlands Region Master Plan establishes a framework for future land use which guides development away from environmentally sensitive lands and promotes compact development and redevelopment in the planned community zone where adequate public facilities are available to serve new growth and development, provided that such development and redevelopment is compatible with existing land uses and community character. The Highlands Regional Master Plan encourages development within existing development areas. In this next section, there is some added language, and it really goes to, again, to comments received. And it's more in line with our conversation this morning with the state agency coordination meeting that we had. And it's in terms of responding to the Act when it talks about the type of areas where you should consider guiding growth and how that growth should look. So there is, in the policies and objectives in this area, it speaks to communities of place, it talks about the mix of uses, it talks about considering things like walking and biking. So they're really principles that are known as smart growth principles that have been included to add to this section. And importantly, I think, as well, to focus on policies such as to integrate public parks and green spaces. So it's really all about the character of the community and making sure that that's taken into consideration in opportunities in future land use. Other than that, I don't think there's that additional language, but nothing that deviates really from the November 30th draft.
What this really is a reorganization of various elements relating to land use into a single section. It was in multiple sections, and I don't believe that there are any substantive changes, but there is a lot of additional information and material about community character, things related to community character in the planned community zone.
I think it's a lot clearer.
Okay. The sections just go on to talk about future land use in protection zones, which is protection zones where we have the highest quality resource value lands, which are essential to maintaining and enhancing water quality and quantity and preserving ecological function. That section then is followed by the conservation zones, again, it's all talking about future land use. No substantive differentiation between this and what we had in the November 30th. Perhaps just again clarification and drawing of the point of these goals, policies, and objectives to one section. And then we get to the planned community zone. Again, the same thing really is true of that zone as well. So conservation and then planned community zones. So I don't think there's a great deal of difference there. The section I think that maybe we should look at somewhat is the subpart 5, which is redevelopment. this is a section that we've added in. Again, some of it may have been referred to in other areas of the RMP, but these goals, policies, and objectives really get to redevelopment. The introduction states that redevelopment is the planning tool that converts underutilized areas, brownfields and greyfields, into new land uses through structure replacement, infill, and adaptive reuse approaches. Redevelopment will help to meet the region's growth needs by maximizing the efficient use of previously settled areas within existing communities and available infrastructure, thus conserving natural resources and protecting drinking water. And I just wanted to add, because of the meeting we had this morning with the Office of Smart Growth, and redevelopment was brought up at that meeting, and there was Ben Spinelli had spoken to the LHRL, the redevelopment and housing law, and there's a process there for areas in need of redevelopment that have to go through a process and be approved by the Department of Community Affairs, so that a community can have an area in need of redevelopment. And what I wanted to do is just call out that there's a difference between those areas in need of redevelopment and the opportunity afforded to this council under the Act, which allows this council to work with a municipality to draw basically an area in need of redevelopment based on 70% of impervious cover, which allows it to develop out a further 30 when you have drawn the area and designated what that area is. That can be done on a site-by-site basis, or it can be done, you know, in a town. It could be done in a town centre, for example. That process, after working with this council, when the council decides what the lines are, that where that area is, where it's appropriate, then the process moves to DEP for the ability to have waivers from the strict regulations. That process holds true in the preservation area, and then for a town that would conform in the planning area. That is not subject to the review of DCA. It is not the same as a quote-unquote area in need of redevelopment. I just wanted to call that out because I found that people are confused to that. And you know, we'll be working closely with DEP on that, and we're setting up procedures already and have a couple of pilot projects. And it's very important in the context of this chapter to realise that that opportunity exists, both in preservation and planning area, and it goes to economic viability and opportunities for redevelopment.
Before you go on, I have one comment. I'm engaged in a debate with the Department of Community Affairs at the moment. You refer to Greyfields, and you spell it G-R-E-Y-E-Y. Greyfields is spelled G-R-A-Y Fields. G-R-E-Y is the proper name of a person. G-R-A-Y is the color. And DCA and I are engaged in this ongoing debate over this. And, you know, once an editor, always an editor, and I can't help myself, so I apologize for intruding, but I think we should be clear about that.
So are you telling me, Jack, that the DCA does the G-R-E-Y spelling as well?
Yes, they do.
Yes.
We've been misled by them.
We've been misled by them. So we'll it's great to cast the blame. We're casting that version. This, a lot of this was taken in coordination with them. They have an interagency team, and the state transfer.
Probably where it came from. And New Jersey has a lot of problems. We don't want to add illiteracy to it.
We will change that, and we will also share that with Ben Spinelli. We should have the opportunity. But Corey is here, I'm sure, to carry it back.
Oh,
so, thank you for that, and we'll make sure we correct it in our documents.
It's part of harmonization.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question? Why do we limit brownfields and gray fields just to commercial or industrial locations? I mean, it could be any place. It could be an abandoned residential, a whole block of townhouses that's now abandoned. I don't know why we have to differentiate.
Mm-hmm.
Just
places
that are no longer functioning or underutilized.
Brownfields are typically sites where there's suspicion of contamination or contamination. The grey fields, generally speaking, you know, we use them to refer to the strip malls on the roads where we see underutilized and opportunities for, but there are provisions within the Act, of course, to deal with residential.
The introduction says great deals are usual sites usually containing industrial and commercial facilities.
Mm-hmm. But certainly there are opportunities under the exemptions as well for redevelopment opportunities within residential sites, and there will be those as well. If we could add language that makes that clearer, we'll gladly do so. We don't want to ignore it. Again, in this section, I don't think there's anything that would, you know, it is protective of the resources. It's it gives guidance to opportunities that exist, and follows basically the mandates of the Act. So, unless there's any comments on that, everybody's happy with that. I would just like to acknowledge that, you know, again, the great deal of work, and in particular Chris Stannis has led on this and on transportation issues. Well, that's what your name does to the system.
CD from now on.
Yes. The next section is on the smart growth section. It's somewhat captured in previous sections as well, obviously, when it comes to speaking about transportation and redevelopment opportunities. Smart growth is an approach to resource planning and management where growth and development are concentrated and organised around what are known as centres. Smart growth promotes land use patterns with a sense of community in place, multimodal and alternative use of modes of transportation, a balance of employment and housing, and an equitable distribution of the costs and benefits of development. Smart growth also includes the preservation and enhancement of natural and cultural resources. This section is there's nothing in this I think that would cause concern of the members, and comments I received indicated that people were generally speaking happy with this. The goal is just the use of smart growth principles to guide development and redevelopment in the Highlands region, and that speaks to what the introduction made clear, and things such as, you know, mixed use and the use of transportation and everything that one would consider appropriate in these particular areas. And by definition, smart growth would imply that you take the correct measures as well for preservation. The next section is housing, and the introduction states that the Highlands Regional Master Plan seeks to address a full range of housing needs for the region. This includes the needs to address low and moderate income ranges, as well as middle and upper income housing needs. In addition, the region should support a variety of housing types, such as rental housing, multifamily housing, age-restricted housing, and supportive and special needs housing. The Highlands Regional Master Plan seeks to provide mechanisms to address the need to have a full range of variety and choice in housing opportunities in the Highlands region. In some cases where the introduction differs from what you have in your latest draft, it's because of the timing involved in all of this. But I think it captures it pretty much in the introduction there. What is most important to draw your attention to here is these policy 6711, which is the first policy under the goal, market rate and affordable housing, sufficient to meet the needs of the Highlands region. This policy underneath that goal says to establish a region-wide comprehensive approach to addressing residential needs in the Highlands region, serving all age groups, income levels and mobility options, but further confirms a policy that this council has very much stood behind and I think bears repetition. Conforming municipalities must prepare and submit a petition for substantive certification on COA. And that's always been your policy, and I think it's important just to draw your attention to it.
Will the Highlands Council then defer to the COA requirements or take them into greater consideration than we might something else?
We're taking a coordinated approach with them, with COA. We've been sharing these documents with them, like we have with other state agencies. The Act calls for that coordinated approach. We certainly need to work with them on towns that fall within, and actually you have it, you had an exemption for towns that fall within entirely within the within the preservation area, that they have an exemption that it allows them to have a municipally afforded project which is 100% COA and gets an exemption under
a waiver.
Thank you, Tom. A waiver. So, but there will be continuing work with them because there are communities that fall, you know, to a great extent within the preservation area who are going to need assistance in meeting their obligations. But we do recognise that the obligations are there.
I'd just like to say again that I think that the COA requirements are going to be a potential problem for TDR receiving areas, because if a community decides that they will increase their density in order to take advantage of the TDR program, that means that they'll also have to increase, they'll have an increase in their COA housing requirements, and that could be a real negative for towns.
Right, and we have recognized that. That's the growth share requirement under round three.
I really think that we should look for some type of reprieve from that.
I'm not going to respond to that.
Well, I guess more broadly, DCA is now reformulating those rules in response to the court's decision, right? Are we interacting with them to try to make sure that how those rules come out do not do harm to our objectives?
Well, we've certainly weighed in on their reexamination of those rules, but I think there always will be a fundamental tension to the extent that their revised growth, their methodology requires you address that increased burden. That's going to be there. I think the court made it clear that COA didn't go far enough. So I think we'll have to look at, like, going back to water deficits, looking at ways to define solutions for these problems.
Right. I'm way out of my league when I start talking about COA, but I know that there are provisions or consideration for environmental open spaces.
Yes.
So I'm just suggesting perhaps that we pursue, while they're in that development, that same kind of consideration for things like the TDR program. And I agree with Mimi, we don't want to throw more roadblocks in the way that we can help avoid.
Okay. Well, as Tom says, we have been coordinating with them, and we did, we've sort of alerted them to the fact that the ability to develop within the Highlands will change after the adoption of the plan, and we wanted to make them very aware of that, because our concerns were that if they come up with the numbers methodology before our plan, they can't take into consideration the limitations that Tom was referring to, such as water deficit areas. So we've certainly done our best alerting them to that fact, and that we were hopeful, and I don't know if it will come to fruition, that some language might be inserted that would reflect.
Well, it's in the statute. The statute requires that COA examine our master plan once it's adopted in examination of third round submittals. So they can't anticipate our final plan while they're doing their rules. So they will have to revisit that once we adopt our plan.
Maybe our plan should have some kind of at least commentary in there that.
Our concern was just the timing, because they're doing their numbers now and we don't have our plan now, but we wanted if they could insert language that sort of makes sure that they achieve that obligation, which is to come back and get it.
What would that would do, that either the funds that we would be contributing to the municipality, they would either have to turn around and use that to provide more affordable housing and then they don't come out ahead, or you're going to tell the developer he's got to provide even more affordable housing, which might make it economically unfeasible for them to develop, and I think it's a serious issue.
I think the point's one thing, because I think now that DCA has a commissioner again, they're going to move ahead more aggressively on this, and so there's probably more going on in the next couple of months.
But we've got to make our case.
Yeah, we'll keep our eye on it, as we have been doing. But and again, we're sharing this information. These documents did go down as well. The next section is titled Landowner Fairness. The Highlands Act recognises that implementation of a regional master plan which directs and guides future development inevitably has an impact on landowner expectations regarding future land use potential. The Act provides several mechanisms that seek to mitigate such impacts, including a transfer development rights program, land acquisition exemptions and waivers. And in this case, the goals are the protection of lands that have limited or no capacity to support human development without compromising the ecological integrity of the Highlands region through mechanisms including but not limited to a region-wide transfer of development rights program. So this talks to the TDR program. It also talks to the provision for compensation to landowners in the preservation area whose properties have limited or no capacity to support additional development and who are disproportionately burdened by the provisions of the Highlands Act through a region-wide, it's the TDR. So what we talk to here is the TDR program, which you will see in the when we come to the programs. It speaks to the creation of the bank and the establishment of the program and having the receiving zones in order to create that positive market. Also in this is it speaks to the different exemptions that are offered under the Act and the recognition and respect for the possible existence of the vested rights of development. Again, that speaks to what the Act dictated was to be considered. So this there's nothing in this, I believe, that really deviates again from the November 30th plan. But just to say, obviously, we've made more progress on TDR and on the exemptions, and we're continuing the work. We did give you an abstract on the exemptions. We're continuing that work to spatially reflect the exemptions and also to give you more information, because we did get requests from the council as well as from members of the public on an analysis that would reflect the exemptions from a county and municipal perspective, so that they could see what it means to them from a county-wide view and a municipal-wide view. We're continuing that work, and all of that goes to this section. Getting close to the end.
I've got a question on that. Excuse me, that last section. The policy 737, I just want to make sure I understood that. I think it's on the bottom of page 63. Is that selling them to the bank then, or is that what that is, or is it? Is that what you're talking about?
To provide an opportunity for landowners who receive an allocation of Highlands Development Credits to sell their Highlands Development Credits in advance of the establishment or receiving their own zones through municipal conformance. This is something that actually Jeff was leading us on this conversation, working with the TDR committee. That was what was anticipated. Yes, through the bank.
Through capitalization of the bank.
Yeah. Right. And it was to allow for sort of the program to move ahead for those,
right,
so that we could actually get something moving.
Right, thank you.
Okay. Sustainable economic development. This, again, speaks to the maintenance of the economic and fiscal vitality of the Highlands communities. And so there's nothing in this that differs. Again, it's just a editing, really, and pulling of these goals and policies together. Nothing from that really differentiates between this and the November 30th edition.
Mr. Chairman, just want to point out under this section, there was a lot of debate on policy 7.4.1 and 2 amongst the council, and I didn't, looking at public comments, I don't have a good sense, and I know we have completed the complete analysis of all of the public comments, but still, I don't have a sense whether this, since this is unchanged basically from what was decided by the council, and I personally disagreed with this, does this mean that we're moving ahead despite public comments on this? Did you consider public comments not significant on these issues, and therefore we're leaving it as was decided? That is, that the lands within redevelopment of brownfield sites approved by the Highlands Council within the preservation area may be receiving zones for TDR credits.
So reading the policy, lands located within redevelopment and brownfield sites approved by the Highlands Council within the preservation area may also be designated as receiving zones by a Highlands municipality, subject to a conformance determination by the Highlands Council.
Right.
We did receive significant comments on this, but we received comments on both sides of the issue. Mm-hmm. So, and it was something that the council, it isn't changed from November 30th, if you wish to revisit it, though.
Right. I know it wasn't changed. Yeah. And I don't want to re-debate every single policy, but I just feel very strongly about that policy and feel this is a huge mistake. And was just wondering how the public comment may have influenced this policy. But not enough, you're saying.
I don't think it's up to the staff to decide if it's not enough. I mean, maybe what we could do is pull that from the comments, pull the category, and allow you to look at it. I certainly wouldn't say that that the staff made an independent decision.
Tracy's question is, why was it unchanged?
Well, and staff, and I think the answer is the staff wasn't convinced it should be changed.
Yeah. based on the comments, because we receive comments, you know, both sides of the issue.
Which, again, doesn't mean we can't change it.
Right.
Same thing on policy 744, having to do with allowing TDR credit, the TDR program to be participated in by municipalities that are not conforming with the plan. Same issue, just want to flag it. I think it's a big issue, and I disagree with this.
Well, we did have a substantive debate on that.
We did.
We did.
Okay, and I guess, well, you've had the discussion on this,
but my concern is to do the state TDR bill as well. For us to see the public comments on, public comments on those issues.
And just as a matter of process, on issues that perhaps only one or two council members may feel should require a vote, how are we going to do this towards the end? I know there's some issues that have been obvious that we're going to need to have actual votes on, when we come, you know, this version or that version.
Right.
Can perhaps maybe a suggestion, council members flag certain policies, like these two policies that I feel strongly about, that for us to consider actually taking a vote on in the last meeting.
Well, I think there's two parts of the process that I've been doing. One is to do what we did only once today, but to the extent that the staff gives us, the drafts the staff give us, to the extent any council members feel anything in here should be changed, if there's a majority of the council that feels that should be changed, then the staff should change it now. That's the first part. And then the second part, and we did that earlier, one issue, and then the second part is when we get to the full document, we're going to have to basically have a motion on the table for them to re-propose the plan, the document in front of us, and then people make amendments for things they want to change. And hopefully there will have been enough discussion beforehand that we can all sort of have some sense of you know, which ones are most potential to bring up, and where one or two members may be out on their own. Is that responsive?
Sort of. I just, you know, there's some, I feel we now have experts, planning experts, that know a lot about TDR, and our consultants maybe could enlighten us, so, and convince me that I shouldn't be so worried. But I mean, maybe, you know, a white paper that on TDR at some point will help to flesh out these issues, and just, you know, would like to see this revisited. Perhaps other council members would too.
Well, I guess that's the question of whether, I mean, whether another council person wants to revisit it, given the time pressures everybody's under tonight.
Mr. Chairman, there are going to be parts of the RMP, I think, with which I might disagree. But that doesn't mean that I will or will not accept the plan as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I think we're talking about those refinements, and maybe a minority report is what you're looking for, or something of that nature. I mean, I don't know. It's up to the chair to decide that. But I think we're going to have before us, ultimately, a plan. In its entirety, as John aptly put it, that we are going to have to consider, and on which we will vote, and whether we will accept the plan with all its hopefully not many flaws or items with which we disagree or not is going to be up to the individual members. So,
Mr. Chairman, maybe we should take a straw vote on these issues. I mean, we have been down the road with these issues before.
I'd just like to add, if I could, I mean, we did consider the public comments, but there's a fairly compelling role for the TDR program to play in this act, and because the receiver zones are primarily in the planning area, we think it's important to have near-term opportunities. That's why the credit bank provision is there, to acquire the rights. And if there are opportunities to mitigate within designated redevelopment areas, those are fairly well narrowly described in the. I think I have at least contributed to the dialogue that when there's a choice like that, that we will be best served by promoting the effectiveness of the TDR program, because in the long term, if it's successful, if it gets going, and nothing in the TDR world works better than success, the initial transactions are what set the stage and drive the future. So from my perspective and the dialogue that I've had internally, I have encouraged it. I suggested that the objections, while I recognize their basis, in balance, I recommended that we maintain the policy as it is. But I think also we have a lot to bring to you about the details of the TDR program and in specific how they're used, because that's not been affirmatively addressed in a programmatic style previously, that may help ameliorate. We do know that there are heightened concerns, and that comes out of it.
I just make a comment with regard to towns that do not are not part of the conformance process that are in the planning area and not allowing them to be receiving area. We have supported the legislation that says that any town in New Jersey can be a receiving area. So what we would be saying essentially, Tracy, is that, okay, everybody in New Jersey can be a receiving area except towns in the planning area that haven't participated in conformance. I don't think that makes sense now. We've got to be consistent.
Well, we can debate that. I think it does make sense, but because we're supposed to be making a plan for the planning area. That's the difference, the big difference between that and other towns throughout New Jersey.
Your concern about this, that you don't want to raise this, you're not suggesting we raise this for another short quote at the present time, is that right?
Well, if people want to raise their hands right now, then, that I don't think there's a problem with taking a straw vote now. I think, and what I'm hearing from Charlie, he feels that he's going to address this further when we get to the programmatic discussion, but I don't want to say, I don't want this to go by and then lose the opportunity to address this issue. And I think what you were saying, John, is that say it now, take a vote now, because we're not going to have, the process is not really going to allow for us to do a lot of this debating at the very end.
Well, that's this is a sort of more formal process at the end where any member of the council can propose an amendment to change anything in the draft we have in front of us.
Okay.
And discuss it and vote it up or down at that point.
Sure.
But it's, certainly the more of those issues we can resolve ahead of time, the better.
Okay.
I guess one thing I'd like to see whether or not the staff could explore as they go through that programmatic aspect. I mean, I share Tracy's concern about the idea that some of the redevelopment areas at least get on the list because of the fact that they are historic decisions about where development occurred, right? The 70% impervious cover. They may not be the places we would have chosen to identify as being growth centers. And so we ought to, while I appreciate the idea that we need near-term opportunities to utilize TDR, we should also have maybe a longer-term program to figure out where those areas are, and how do we perhaps take places that might be potential specially planned areas and move them into conservation or some other more appropriate thing. And that might be a part of the program going forward. And I don't know which tools we've brought to bear, but in the way it's structured right now, it's basically, we're in a responsive role. Right? People come in and say, I want to designate this area, it meets the criteria, and we probably are going to do that. And you open that opportunity by saying it's part of a conformance determination or subject to conformance determination. But it may go to Tracy's concern or the concern about, are we directing growth into places that are not the right places, but they're simply places where people have built before.
Right. And that was the argument.
So I would say, let's not take a vote today, but let's see if that's something that could be addressed somehow, or some ideas come forward on it. Maybe that's a better way to do it.
I think in part some of the concerns will be answered when we look at the lands model, because I think you'll see a refinement there that goes to some of these issues, both on the protection and on the development side. So I think that will be beneficial to you. I also think that in terms of the 70% redevelopment opportunity, and I certainly the staff has recognized that the growth is certainly not necessarily where one would have planned to have placed it had one had that opportunity. And at the same time, in the pilot projects we've been looking at, if you have a business that's already in existence in the area and seeks to redevelop, there's an opportunity. But again, it needs your approval to recognize that as an area in need of redevelopment. But you're faced with a decision that a business can make the decision to stay within the area or leave, and should it leave, we may have a brownfield on our hands. So again, it's all of this balancing. But we appreciate what you're saying, and certainly I think that there will be, I think, when we look at November 1st at the lands model, that you'll see a further refinement that will assist us.
John, can I make a comment on this?
Just a minute, Debbie. The way I see these policies is to say that to the extent we're saying development is acceptable in the preservation or the planning area, those sites are acceptable as potential receiving areas for TDR. That we're not setting up sites where we would say development's acceptable, but not as a TDR receiving area. Yeah, Debbie.
Yeah, John, I'm trying to, and I struggled with this the last time, trying to understand what the concerns are about this, and there may have been the nuance that while we have the statement in there, and non-conforming municipalities would retain eligibility, I believed we had discussed that the council has to approve that TDR program. So the safeguard is, while ideally we would like the municipality to conform, for whatever reason they're not, they could not build, their receiving area could not be in an area that would be in conflict with the regional master plan or policy. And am I wrong on that? And if not, then Tracy and Tim, I don't understand what the concern is.
No, I think you're right. The language is that Highland municipalities may seek designation of receiving zones, and they're seeking it from the Highlands Council. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and all along, staff has responded that, but they have to still meet, they still can't conflict with the environmental resources. There's still constraints going to be put on them. And I appreciate what Charlie said, is that they're fairly narrowly prescribed or described, these areas. There's going to be a lot of limits, and not that many of them, perhaps, are going to be receiving areas or appropriate for development. But I think the crux of the argument, as far as I'm concerned, is what Tim said, and it's what we spent time discussing last time, is that there were some mistakes or whatever you want to call it, some development historically over the years put in areas that are very environmentally sensitive. And why should we now set that in stone? We have the opportunity to change that. And I think, you know, we know that historical development is often along waterways. It's often way too close to a natural lake. And we don't want to be repeating the sins of our fathers. And we have an opportunity here to do something different. And I think that's the crux of my concern, is that we're just repeating the same old mistakes. And I'm not saying that we're not doing anything else. I'm just afraid that in the end, that might be the effect for those that meet the 70% or the brownfields or gray fields, which then are made TDR zone, receiving zones. In the preservation area in particular, which is supposed to be the most protected and pristine area.
In terms of the 70%, they have to get approval first by this council and then by DEP to be granted the waivers from the strict regulations. So I think you've got two points. I mean, even should this council approve something, there's a further review by Department of Environmental Protection. I would hope that both those reviews will be substantive enough to make sure that there isn't, that there's adequate protection for the natural resources. So I think I would echo Debbie, if I might, in saying that these are opportunities where they can apply, but it's subject to the review of this council. So it only opens up an opportunity, but doesn't give them anything until they've been subjected to your review.
Wouldn't we apply, if somebody applied to be a TDR receiving area and they weren't in conformance, we would still apply our environmental standards mm-hmm. to that receiving area that they're requesting, right?
They have to meet the TDR requirements of the Act, and that would actually put them through, and we discussed this morning, through the purview of Office of Smart Growth to make sure that they met the requirements of the State TDR Act if they are outside of the, if they do not conform. I'm speaking to communities within the planning area that don't conform.
But the site would have to adhere to our
yes.
buffer constraints, our steep slope constraints, whatever.
Do we have a policy statement that says that?
Says that it has to do that? That's something.
Maybe that's one way to.
Yeah,
that would help because yeah. that's a big question. And I know that Tom had explained way back that environmentally constrained areas are not going to be thrown into that pot. But I think what Tim is saying might help us, because I don't know that it is spelled out, particularly when an applicant might think, because it fits a waiver definition, that it's exempt. So I think we just have to define this further.
We're going to be creating little areas, little islands of conformance in areas of non-conformance.
Well, let's see.
But I think it goes to the point this morning, though, we will still be participating through the plan endorsement process, which is required for TDR receiving. So we will have a say of that matter for the entire town. The entire town has to conform. It's not just pockets.
Right. They have to be endorsed. The entire town has to be endorsed.
Yes.
I think the policy statement needs some reference to appropriate criteria, yes. And then there needs to be a program that identifies what those criteria are for the designation of a receiver zone in a non-conforming municipality.
Right. 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 Yes, that would help a lot.
See, it works. It's a process.
Tim, you're nearly there. Bear with us. Part 8 is sustainable economic development. Again, this is just a pulling of the goals and policies that were and objectives from your November 30th together. There's nothing, I believe, that's new here. It deals with sustainable economic development. It deals with agriculture. It deals with tourism and recreation, encouraging these, and expansion of innovative technology and entrepreneurial business, including home office, energy efficiency, and resource conservation enterprises in the region.
I would just add, there's a little more emphasis on agro and ecotourism, and promoting some additional uses to make that happen, and some additional studies. We think there's a lot of opportunities there. And there is an emerging trend around the country about, I hate to use the home office, but the ability to live in a place with a high quality of life and to be able to do a substantial amount of economic activity within a home that a lot of existing municipal regulations do not allow. And we think that's a subject that needs to be addressed over the long term, because some of that stuff is much more compatible with what we're trying to achieve than attracting an industrial plant to the region. But other than that, I think it just reflects that. And that's it, Mr. Chairman.
The last section is air quality.
Oh, I'm sorry. How could I have forgotten air quality?
And air quality, just the Highlands Act recognizes that the Highlands region includes exceptional natural resources such as clean air. It's from Section 2. And the Highlands Regional Master Plan seeks to establish mechanisms for the protection and enhancement of air quality resources for the Highlands region that consider the interplay of air quality conditions at local, regional, interstate and global levels. And then the goal under this is the reduction of air pollution through use of alternative and efficient modes of transportation and the use of renewable energy sources. So, again, this is just something a requirement of the Act and our obligation and some goals, policy, and objectives to follow.
And why is Warren County singled out in the policy? The last policy to support state and federal initiatives that will reduce air pollution in Warren County and the region?
Because of the out of state.
Because of the, yeah.
The out of state.
Right, that was why.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question on policy 915 on page 70. The 914, I'm sorry. You're mentioning a certain few things there, ozone, sulfur dioxide, and fine particulate matter pollutants, which are, of course, important. But I always get worried when we start making lists and then we're leaving things out. Like, I would want to put mercury in there, for instance, because mercury is, you know, definitely is known to have a problem in terms of when it is deposited on water, it then has the opportunity to create in the water body a deadly pollutant. So I don't know if we want to start adding. I would add mercury. I just think it's one we should single out. But I didn't know whether you had looked at some list and found, you know, these were the ones that were the top air pollutant problems in the region or not, or were you just picking up from public comment, or, you know, how was this?
My understanding, it's from the prior draft, and my understanding, the source of it was, these were the particular contaminants of concern or pollutants of concern.
The non-attainment contaminants.
Yes.
The ones that the Highlands region does not attain?
Yes.
Okay. So I would suggest mercury. I don't know if mercury is on that list, then. It's not.
It's interesting because mercury is not there as an air pollutant. its problem is when it becomes no longer in the air.
It's the water.
Because that's the driver back to air. So there,
right.
As far as I know, we are not in violation for mercury in the air. We have a problem with mercury in the water because of the air.
That's right. So, I mean, I think for that reason, it would be reasonable to add mercury to this list. I don't know that we have to stick to just what the pollutants of concern are.
Tracy, we can add it, and we can also say including but not limited to, so that we're not boxed
okay.
in the future with further studies if there's something else.
Put radon in
there. Absolutely, and including but not limited to. That does bring us to the end of the goals.
Well, thank you very much. This is a lot of work, and this is driven. I think it's going to be important going forward to whatever the editing process is that we all in the council can be aware of changes that are out, so that if you make even wording changes, maybe not numbering changes, but maybe those, that the next time, the next drafts we see, that we can refer back to this one. That they refer back to this one.
We do keep all of this, and we keep a record of it, and I mean, it's already, frankly, I think it's now in 3 or 4 folders. There's so much of it that's been back and forth. We will do that, and we continue to have track changes so that one can look back and capture the changes over time.
But that's going to be important going from this draft.
That's
forward.
Right. From this document forward.
Yeah, what we'll do is what we'll do is we'll create a new folder from this moment on so that we don't go back in time.
Because we've had numerous internal
iterations
and we need not to, can't go back from that. Thank you.
Good job.
The next two items on the agenda, there's an executive session. I don't think there's any need to go into the executive session unless public comment. How many people in the public would like to speak? What's the council going to keep going up? Are people not like to speak? what councilor's pleasure? We can take a 10-minute break and.
Does anybody have?
Let's take a 10-minute break.
Let's take a 10-minute break. Okay, so we'll come back at 1:15.
Mr. Chairman, could I just beg the council's indulgence for just a moment? I apologize. Today we have with us Lane Kendig and Gary Mitchell, who are with Kendig Keast, who are working with us on the program. And they have been here all week traveling and working, and we're depending on that. I just didn't introduce them, and I apologize for that. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for
all
your efforts. Okay, we'll come back at
1:15.
Tracy?
Yes.
What was the other policy number that you questioned just before the 7.4.4?
Okay, hold on. I'm looking it up.
I feel like last comic standing.
I apologize that we're not able to provide food for everyone.
But it was good.
But it was good, yes. And then we're not able to eat it more quickly. Is there anyone who would like to speak who hasn't spoken before to the council? Okay. Then who would like to speak?
I'm Nancy Chambell, and I'm with the Warren County Environmental Commission. A few thoughts came to my head in three areas, one being vernal pools. I know that primarily environmentalists are concerned about the sustainability of amphibian species, but I have actually had firsthand experience with another aspect of the importance of vernal pools, and that has been some flood control. And I thought it might be helpful to the council to consider that. In my town, more than a decade ago, a very large vernal pool, about an acre or so, was filled in and built upon. And I didn't even know what a vernal pool was until it was gone, because the impact was flooding to my home and several other existing residents. And we have waited 12 years. I have missed a few of the meetings because I've been with county engineers and backhoes in my yard, trying to actually get some sort of relief from this flooding that has gone on now for more than a decade because of filling in one vernal pool. During the major storms, my furnace could be filled anywhere from 18 inches, 3 feet, 5 feet of water. So there was a lot of property damage annually for each of the houses involved. The county road would be completely closed because it was a lake. The water that used to be in the vernal pool now is overflowing and covering the road and backing up into our houses. Hurricane Floyd was the worst for me. Hurricane Ivan was a little less. That was a 3 feet. And the nor'easter, I had 18 inches and my neighbor had 3 feet. But it was all inside the house, up in the furnace, putting us in danger of electrocution until we figure out how to get the electricity off. So that's another aspect to really carefully taking care of vernal pools and not dismissing them, because the impact in dollars to each of us has been significant, and not to mention the county, who I believe the drain system they have just put in, it was a multi-million dollar proposition, and the townships, what they need to do to even get closer to remediating the problem hasn't even been assessed yet until we see what this new system does. So in the area of vernal pools, I just thought it would be helpful for the council to know that human impact, and for those of you who like dollars and cents and that sort of thing. In the section of forestry and thinking about forest integrity, I thought of something that also impacts. You're talking about clear-cut forest. We have something that's emerging as a commodity in our area of Warren County, perhaps Sussex. I'm not familiar with it there. But it's limestone harvesting. And in pounding the ground and taking away the rocks, I'm seeing tremendous amount of trees going down as if they were clear-cut. In the past, three or four would go down on a steep slope. Now there are dozens going down each year. And I believe it's a soil conservation issue, but I was hoping that the council could address that in the regional master plan, because it will be affecting forest integrity. And again, that may contribute to some more flooding if that's not somehow regulated or some oversight of this new emerging activity on steep slope land. The third area of my concern is the air quality. I would like to see the council take a little bit stronger stand on some of the air quality issues. Particularly, the monitoring is not occurring across the region. Warren County, I think, it's done most intensively. Morris County has some. But there are several of the Highlands County where there are no monitors at all. I personally feel it's very important to have a baseline of air quality before the smart growth comes in, so you can really see what it was and the impact that the growth and the master plan implementation is going to have on the areas. As far as what those monitors test for, right now it's very varied. I think it's very important that wherever the monitors are, that they test for the same kind of chemicals, and in my case, the same policy that Tracy picked up on was one that I was looking at. One of the things that is really having a tremendous impact on public health are the VOCs, and they are not tested on every monitor, and they're not tested in every county. So that I think is very important to have a monitor, at least one in every county, and that they test for several select chemicals of VOCs. You know, whatever they would be, but that they do it consistent, that there be monitoring, that it be consistent, and lastly, that it be long-lasting. In Warren County, we do have the monitoring, but it's temporary. It's only 2 years that we know of for now, and each time the citizens have to organize and make a case to have it go on. So I think there needs to be a long-lasting monitor as well as being consistent and across the region.
David Shope, I have a farm in Long Valley. First, a little perspective. The most densely populated state in the nation has the same population as New York City. And on page 37, 3.1.5,
I would like you to include the verbiage, and I would like you to include fee simple as a specifically as a agricultural preservation tool. Because when I read the catch-all phrase in other agricultural land conservation techniques, that means to me even more restrictive regulation. And in the meetings that are reported by Mrs. Swan that she attends with other members of staff here, I read the newspapers correctly, members of the environmental community like Dave Pfeiffer, Julia Summers, etc., also attend with her. And I would like to, I would like, as part of the record of this council, to have all people who share the dais with Highlands Council staff be mentioned in the executive director's report. And I would also like to ask, while we're on the subject, are any other lobby groups invited to attend these meetings, for instance, the Builders Organization and so forth? I suspect not. And also, as part of the executive director's report, I noticed that she mentions that she meets with the Highlands Coalition, which is a lobbying group. I would like to know if she meets with any other lobbying groups. Several months ago, perhaps a year ago, Kurt Alstead asked, and Helen Heinrich recently asked, for an overlay of all the restrictions. We're all dying to see a totally black picture of the what can be allowed to be built in the area. I think it will be essentially black except for a pinhole here and there. I look forward to seeing this, this overlay. Also, I would like to do an analysis I did several years ago in Lebanon Township as to who really pays for watershed land preservation. And the difference in time between now and then only exacerbates the what I'm about to tell you. In Lebanon Township, between county and municipal open space tax, on a house valued $300,000, which is a little on the light side now, that's $300 a year. The household is typically 2.7, less than 3, but let's say 3 because it makes a nice even number of $50 per person, per household, per year for open space land preservation tax. The user of water from this area pays 21 cents per person per year for land that is preserved on the backs of the landowners and on the backs of the taxpayers up here at the rates I just suggested. You're soon going to be digging out your tax bills because November 1st is coming. You can do the your own analysis in your own towns. It's easy. And towns like Mendham and Chester where $300,000 is not a good number, you will find that you're paying even more for land preservation so that people down where the water goes can pay 21 cents per person per year. The low flow margin of safety is a bogus methodology, and it just doesn't stand up. Why don't you use the average or median, whatever it is, the same as you use for nitrate dilution and other methods of doing your doing any calculation? Would you plan your future on what you have in the bank today? Not necessarily. You would take your income and do an averaging calculation. That's all I have. Thank you.
Respond in part to say that the staff and members of the council speak wherever we're invited, whenever we can accommodate our schedule. I'm speaking to the Community Builders of New Jersey on November 15th. That's one example.
Mr. Chair, can I just verify as well that when I go to these municipal meetings, I go as staff on my own or with other members of staff, but I do not share the dais with anybody if I'm representing the Highlands Council, unless I'm in a presentation where they're already invited members. But when I speak to counties and towns, I go as your representative, and I invite nobody to join the dais with me. I represent you, and likewise the staff.
Well, let me just say that I only know what I read in the newspapers, and the newspapers say...
Every so often, the newspaper's not entirely accurate. Not as far as
hear that, you all?
Good afternoon. Andy Drysdale, Chester Township. I didn't really write up anything today to read to you. I just have a couple of comments. It's fine to talk about preserving the water, and we all care about the environment. Everybody wants to drink clean water, but if you look at what happened in the past, just one example was it's probably environmental extremists from a previous generation, and maybe some of them are still around, I guess, I don't know, that you had the Tox Island Dam where you probably would have plenty of water if that project had gone forward. They kicked all the people out, and then you decided not to do it. And then what you have today is going on in other countries. You've got all these developing countries that are developing very rapidly and polluting the heck out of the air and stuff, and I'm sure a lot of it's coming here. The natural process of evaporation and is good, but it's not perfect, and a lot of that stuff gets through. So no matter what you do here in the Highlands area, you're still going to have polluted water coming down, falling out of the sky. And you probably should be collecting it all over the state and using water filters, which can be gotten very reasonable. They're very available, and there's more technology all the time regarding that, and they can take out most of the pollutants out of the water, probably, and in some cases it's much better than the bottled water that you buy. They're available in all different prices. You can go in Walmart and you can see them. Some as low as $20-some, which, and the better ones are up to $150, and they go on up to, depending on what you want to do. You can even have filters that'll take nitrates out, nitrites and nitrates. But that's a more complicated, more expensive process. I don't know if any of them will take the radioactive stuff out. That's really what I just wanted to point out some of these things to you. I think with all the increase in population that's going to take place in the next, say, 20 years or whatever, that what's going to happen is everybody's going to have a water filter, no matter what you do here in the Highlands. That's my opinion. Thank you very much.
Other comments? Thank you. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Thanks.
Are you debating whether to speak? Or you?
Pardon me?
You
no, I'm not. Oh, well, okay. I'm okay. Trying to collect my thoughts so that I don't totally just ramble. Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. In the forestry section, this first section of the plan, I hope that that eventually the language in here can be changed, that the exemption is for not a forest management plan, but a forest stewardship plan, because a forest stewardship plan would be much more in accord with the goals and objectives of the Highlands Act than a forest management plan. And as was pointed out earlier, this Senate bill, Senate 2677, would eventually require forest stewardship plans in the Highlands as opposed to forest management plans, and so that hopefully that would come to pass, and then the forestry done in the Highlands would then be much more compatible with the kind of forest management that is needed in the region, sustainability and removing invasive species and managing for wildlife and so forth. So that would be a good thing. We have a real concern about the water availability numbers and the chart, and really would not support the increased allocations from these areas that are in deficit. The NJCF is part of the Highlands Coalition. We have repeatedly called for a conservative approach to the water issue. I mean, that's the reason the act was passed, was because of the water issue. And it really needs to be conservative. So there can't be all these questions about, well, if they mitigate, we'll let them do more than we otherwise would. I mean, it really needs to be a strong approach that, you know, unfortunately, this is the area that over 5 million people who don't live here actually rely on for water. All over the world, the water is threatened, in Asia, in China, in India, in Latin America, and in the American West, where the Colorado River is dry by the time it reaches the sea. Water is in short supply, and we are finding out that, you know, the council's own research has found out that this area, unfortunately, is also becoming in deficit, and this needs to be taken seriously. I mean, 50 years from now, we want people to be able to rely on water from the Highlands, and you know, the plan has to be done in a way that the water will be sustainable. So I hope that this issue will be addressed in a conservative manner. The same thing with the nitrate dilution issue. I would very much like to have a copy of Mr. Van Epp's memo to more fully understand how this is being approached. But my understanding is that the DEP's GSR32 model is being used as a basis for determining the volume of water that would be the dilutant of the pollutants. And if this model overestimates the amount of water that is actually recharged to groundwater, which it does not do deep aquifer recharge, it just does surficial groundwater recharge, you're going to end up with a greater density of houses based on that formula. So this is a very critical issue. On the transportation issue, The draft that came along last time noted that the transportation goals are different for the planning area and the preservation area. In the planning area, there is a transportation goal, which is to promote a sound, balanced transportation system that preserves mobility in the Highlands. But there is not that goal in the preservation area, and I do not see any distinction made in this document between preservation and planning area goals for transportation, and I think there should be a distinction made. I mean, the Act itself made that clear. The landowner fairness section. It seems to me that while one might have a section entitled that, I think the implication is somehow that every landowner in the Highlands is unfairly affected by this act. I live in the Highlands. I am certainly not unfairly affected by this act. And the majority of people who live in the Highlands are not unfairly, you know, affected, adversely affected. I think there should be some recognition of that, that there should be like, what's the total population? What is the percentage, or what is the number and the percentage of the population of the residents whose properties are in accord with current zoning? In other words, they have no more development potential anyway. So their development potential is not being infringed upon. The only thing that's going to happen with those properties is the value is going to go up. And then what percentage and how many people are there who actually would see a decrease in their development value because of Highlands Act rules and so forth. I think, you know, I think it just needs to be clear that this act is not injuring the entire 800,000 people who live in the Highlands. It needs to be clear. Besides which, it needs to be clear that originally this was sort of thought of, or maybe that's just a different chapter, as equity, and in our comments that we haven't quite completed about the equity issue, it's not just the equity within the Highlands, but it's the equity between people who drink water who don't live in the Highlands, and whether there is a water supply for the half of the state that isn't here versus things that are happening here. So it sort of needs to be looked at in a much broader context. And then lastly, in the sustainable economic development part, I'm looking at the agriculture section, and I think it could be, I will be giving it to our agriculture experts, but it seems to me that it needs to talk about not just enhancing existing agriculture, but talk about innovations, talk about organic farming, talk about the need to have markets and consumers close together. It needs to also talk about the thing in the Act which actually says that there should be incentives developed by the council for farmers that preserve their land with an impervious cover limit of 5%. That needs to be in there as well. So I think that you know, it needs to move beyond what the agriculture actually is today and talk about how it can be better and more innovative in the future. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Tony DiLodovico, with principal with CMX, engineering consulting firm formerly Shorter Palmer. I was at the Natural Resources Committee meeting on September 20th, and I just wanted to clarify some of the notes in the minutes. One with regard to my statement that 9 units at the Heritage 55 site are built. To clarify, it's 9 units have been approved to be built, and 5, at a minimum, 5 are currently built. I don't know as of today if there's any more, but 9 were approved to be built. I did ask for clarification at that meeting on the statement as to DEP was requiring or asking the council to review these water quality management plan amendments based upon the draft regional master plan. And I believe it's not reflected in the minutes, and then I believe the response that I was given was that it's in the regulations, or at least the adopted regulations say that the council is to use whatever data it has available. I just wanted to just clarify for the record, and I could leave this with the council if they would like. I have the regulation. It here, or did I leave that here? I apologize. Here's the regulation that was adopted last year, I believe it was December of last year, and it's 738.1.1, and the item K deals with the water quality management plan amendments. I'll read the whole thing, and I'll emphasize the last sentence that deals with when there's not a plan in place. For both the planning area and the preservation areas, the department shall review the Highlands Council Regional Master Plan and consider amending the appropriate area-wide water quality management plans to maintain consistency with the regional master plan. The department shall approve a water quality management plan amendment only after receiving from the Highlands Council a determination of consistency with the regional master plan to be incorporated by reference in L below, which deals with what the master plan would say, when adopted by the Highlands Council. So it says when adopted, that takes effect. The last sentence then says pending completion of the regional master plan, which is what we are in now. Pending completion of the regional master plan, the department shall not approve a water quality management plan amendment for a project proposed in the planning area or preservation area without first obtaining a recommendation from the Highlands Council. That's all it says, is that the Highlands Council is supposed to give the department a recommendation. It does not clarify how the council is to do that, what they're to review, and I would just make a request to the council that in reviewing these water quality management plans before a master plan is in place, or at least before the draft plan is reissued, if that's the proper word, that the recommendation to the department should be that we are changing our master plan. I believe you're spending over $200,000. I heard lots of discussion today on a portion of it where, to me, it was significantly changing. and specifically some items in there that pertain to water quality management plans would be changing. Until that process is done, that the recommendation would be that the department just move forward in the sake of fairness. In the case of Heritage 55, we submitted a request for recommendation postmarked February 14th of 2007. So I think we're well past, I think, a reasonable time that a recommendation should be given. If, in fact, the council deems, they have every right to, since there is no requirement of how to do it, the council has every right to decide how to make these recommendations. If the council moves forward in making the recommendations based upon the draft master plan that is currently being revised, I would request that the council consider all the aspects of the Highlands Act in making the recommendation, specifically to consider the fact that the Act says that the Highlands Regional Master Plan would be voluntary for towns in the planning area. And I think any recommendation should have that statement in it, and it should also, for Heritage 55, have the statement that the township was at the September 20th meeting and endorsed the project and gave and identified to the council that it was in favor of moving forward with this project. One more issue, and it came up today in the discussion, and I was a little unclear, and so I just wanted to clarify that there was discussion of there was another project, the Mine Hill project that I call it, discussed at that meeting too, and at that during that review, there was lots of discussion about the information that the council had to review the Water Quality Management Plan Amendment, Wastewater Management Plan Amendment in that case, and they had asked that they'd be allowed to give information. For Heritage 55, it's a very short and simple amendment. I believe the council has everything from my submission to the council that they would need to make a review. I did clarify some issues that are on the record I see in the minutes. And we would like a determination at the next meeting. We do not want to wait for additional information. What we will do, however, is I've prepared a response to the review that the staff did, and we did not submit that for today's meeting because we were told there was not going to be action taken, so we decided that we would look at the minutes, we would hear what was discussed today, and early next week I'll be submitting a clarification on our position just so it's in front of the council. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's like the regulation.
But he knows
it. My name is Jody Anderson, and I'm owner of a tree farm in Lebanon Township. Regarding landowner fairness, I personally know a number of people who have been harmed by this act, whose lives have been put in limbo for the past several years. There are undoubtedly many more that I don't know of, people whose lives have been turned upside down and deserve and must have fair and prompt relief to, quoting from this act, mitigate such impacts. And time, in my opinion, should not be wasted on finding those people who have not been harmed. Thank you.
Well, let me go through a couple of English comp teacher things first. I'd like
sorry,
to tell...
Sorry, with introducing yourself.
Oh, I'm Marion Harris from the Morris County Trust for Historic Preservation, not to be confused with the Morris County Historic Preservation Trust, which is much younger and much richer. One thing I'd like to say about the question of glossaries is that I always like to see the glossary definitions all in one place, either at the front or the back of the material, but not scattered around, because you never know what is going to be running through the heads of your readers and when it will suddenly occur to them to wonder what some word means that you haven't even used in the chapter that you're looking at now. And it's much easier to flip to one place where you have one finger in the book rather than to be looking all through it. So that's the doctrine about glossaries. Also, Jack, I'm not sure about gray and gray. And there was a good deal of muttering among linguists in the audience about that one, and I would refer you to Patrick Hank's Dictionary of American Family Names on the subject of names, and to the third edition of Webster for the proper use of the spelling of E-Y or A-Y. But we can talk about this for the next 10 years.
I'm very familiar with those now.
I'm sure you are. Memorize them. Yes, right.
You're saying it's not a black and white matter.
But red all over. Yes.
That's a very good
point. So now let me get into my private sandbox and talk about historic stuff. There is a policy that I really hope you're going to resolve at some point. There's the question of how you are going to get resources added to your inventory if you don't ask your applicants to bring them to you and say, it's here on my property, do you want to list it? That is the process that has been used, was used up until about 5 years by everybody who was carrying out a review under the Federal Historic Preservation Law, Section 106. If you were a cell phone company or if you were a bank starting a new, even installing an ATM, you had to go through a process of saying we're not going to affect any historic resources. And here are the ones that we have found, old and new, not just the ones that are already recognized, not that they're protected, but at least people know what they are. But you have to go back and remember that the recognized resources comprise maybe as much as 6% of the ones that exist. And here is your chance to get your applicants to help you discover the new ones. I do wish that we're going to see this process brought together because, yes, you're right, Eileen, you are listening, and the sculpture is beginning to emerge from the marble, and it's very, very nice to see that this does reflect comments that we've been making. But there is still this issue of how you're going to get stuff to the inventory because you can't wait for people to nominate stuff through SHPO. You have to use the people who are looking. Maybe it's a hardship to require them to hire a consultant, but if it's not a very large property, it's not very expensive, and they are, after all, in the preservation business if they're in the Highlands. So that's where you can increase the size of your inventory. And you do say that you want to develop a process for doing that. So there is the process, and I've described that in a couple of sets of comments that are buried there somewhere, so you could certainly do that. But there are a couple of things about the way this is written that sound kind of strange to an insider because there is some confusion about two different sets of documents. One set is the Secretary of the Interior's standards for doing X to a historic building, not a property because it's not about something that is largely archaeological, although there is archaeology in it. But doing X is restoration. There's one set for restoration. Rehabilitation, there's another one. I think there are four altogether, and there's a lot of overlap in them. But those are for people who are actually dealing with a building. It's not for people who are acquiring buildings. On the other side, there is the criteria for register nomination. And those criteria are identical in New Jersey, so at least you don't have to look at two different things. But those criteria concern age, integrity, and significance. And that's how you decide whether something deserves to be recognized. So recognizing, putting on an inventory, that's one thing with one set of criteria. Working on is another thing. So I'm not sure when I read these things and it says that somebody is going to be dealing with, in some way, historic resources, whether you picture them actually changing those buildings and coming here for a review of those changes. I don't think you're ever going to want to get into reviews at that level of detail. That's usually done by SHPO or by municipal commissions. But what you really want to know is whether this thing is worth saving. And those are the principles that you need to throw around the words for. So if you want to run any of these phrases by to see whether they're idiomatic, that's something that you don't have to do on the book, but we are here to practice that kind of stuff.
Thank you. Any other comments? I see a show of hands. Everyone else wants to speak?
Hi. Kathleen Karen, West Milford. I'm speaking as a private citizen, lifelong resident of New Jersey, and a 13-year resident of the Highlands, and now the Highlands Preservation Area. I want to thank the council and the staff for the work that you're doing. I applaud that. It's going to be, I hope we can get it done in the time frame. I also want to just remind people, and I'm sure you don't need to be reminded, but maybe folks in the audience, that this, what we call the Highlands Act, is actually the Highlands Water Protection and Planning Act, not the Highlands Planning and Water Protection Act, because I think that water protection is the main source, as Wilma had said. I am in favor of a water surcharge. I think that it's only fair that a nominal fee, when people are spending a dollar or a dollar and a half on a bottle of water at 7-Eleven, they can certainly pay a dollar or a dollar and a half a year toward the water that they get through their taps. Right now, we have really not had any really measurable rainfall in about a month, and I don't know how often you get up to Upper Passaic County where the reservoirs are. The reservoirs are really low, and you know, I would say we need to pray for rain, do some rain dance, whatever. But you know, as far as, I mean, I feel as a resident of West Milford that my property has increased because essentially, you know, I'm living in an area that is not going to continue to get battered by new school costs and all those things that go along with development. But at the same time, 95% of my town survives on wells, private wells, and septics. And if we don't protect the groundwater, then, you know, I know that there are people that have farmland or other people that have speculated on land and feel like there needs to be fairness. But if we don't protect the groundwater in that part of the Highlands, then they will be ghost towns. Because if you don't have water in your well, you can't sell your house. It'll be condemned. And so, again, you know, I just hope that people realize that. You know, I heard somebody talk about water filters. Well, if you look at the analysis between what it would cost to build water treatment facilities as opposed to preserving important watershed lands, it's like there's no, it's very, very clear that Mother Nature does it better than anybody. And, you know, while I feel for people who feel wronged by this act, I have to remind people that whatever you invest in, there's always a risk. Nothing is ever a sure thing. And for people who, you know, don't understand the importance of vernal pools and protecting wildlife habitat, then I would suggest that you go see The Lion King on Broadway or rent the Disney movie, because it's the circle of life. And we are experiencing, you know, what we've done to mess up this planet now with global warming. And the people who lived here before, you know, our ancestors lived here, thought about the seventh generation and how their actions would impact the seventh generation. And I think we need to remember that. So thank you.
Our next meeting, the TDR committee, is meeting a week from today at 4 p.m. There are no other committees scheduled at 9 o'clock. And the full council will be again 2 weeks from today at 10 a.m. A motion to adjourn. Move. For a second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Good job, John.
Yes, thank you.
Neither one of them played that good. Yes.
Today? No, no, we'll give you the release. And then we'll find out. We're going to raise it together later if we want. Okay. We're still trying to.